All right, folks, we're ready to start when you are. Ready to start, go ahead. Yep, ready to go.
All right, try again. Good afternoon. First, thanks to each of you for volunteering for the panel. My name is Brady Van England, and I'll be serving as the division's point of contact to the panel. So if you have any questions moving forward, or if there are any concerns you guys have, please let me know and I'll do my best to address them. Pursuant to SB 83, this independent review panel, which is comprised of a diverse group of individuals with expertise in geology, toxics, oil and gas operations, public health, environmental justice, agriculture, and the environment, will evaluate the regulatory performance of the state's UIC program and make recommendations on how to improve its effectiveness by evaluating resource needs, statutory or regulatory changes in program organization. Preston Jordan, to my left, from Lawrence Berkeley National Labs, will be responsible for facilitating the independent review panel, and the issues identified in the SB 83 report are addressed. Today's meeting will provide an introduction to both the subject and the public agencies involved in regulating Class II wells for the panel. After the presentations are complete, the meeting will transition to and be run by the independent review panel in accordance with SB 83. And with that, first, we're going to introduce Secretary John Laird from Natural Resources Agency.
Is this, I usually chair meetings from there in here. I've never had to operate this microphone. So I wanted to just briefly welcome you and thank you for serving. Really, truly appreciate it. And we are in the eighth year of this administration. I was one of the few first day cabinet appointments. And this issue was waiting for us when we got here. And what has been tumultuous in different ways as we've moved through this administration. And yet, I think we've worked really hard to tackle it in any of a number of ways. The legislature adopted regulations with regard to fracking, and we have been charged to implement them. I am frequently asked how you integrate science into what we do, which we have done amazingly in most aspects of the agency in a way it wasn't before. I frequently tell people that we have more scientists in the Fish and Wildlife Department than we have game wardens. And we actually then commissioned a science study. I had a science advisor. We did an EIR with regard to underground injection and the related oil extraction issues, and really involved a discussion and the facts and science and technical experts in ways that they hadn't been before. When, even though we've done it in many aspects, particularly when we were involved in the Aliso Canyon issue, we had the Lawrence Labs on contract consulting before we did any move on that. At any step of the way to make sure we had scientific and expert input. When we walked in the door, and I was sort of incredulous, in the state that has Silicon Valley, every permit, the number that sticks in my head is 50,000 past and currents, was on paper. And so we had a strike team that came up and digitalized it, has done it in phases, and therefore it's much more transparent, but it's much more available to people. We have reorganized the department and dealt with the culture of the department in many ways. And so you just look at it, and we have really sort of tackled it in any of a number of ways and tried to take on just historic things that had not been addressed. And so now, with that bar having been set, this group is created, and this group is created to bring together people of many different technical perspectives and other perspectives in one place to review these things and have input and take a look. And it was really meant in some ways to be more of an in-depth and in some ways technical discussion on these issues rather than an ideological discussion. So that what happened in 1983 with regard to sort of an agreement that couldn't even be documented for the longest time between the feds and the state, that we had to step back from and really completely review every underground injection to decide where it stood in a permitting way, that now, going forward, you will advise on these and advise on your own area of expertise or interest. And it's very important because we are 7 months from a change in an administration. And so this was created by legislation. We support it. But it also provides a touchstone for the next administration to be able to have people at the table. And if somebody walks in the same way I did, fortunately, they're not going to face a lot of the same things with this issue. But you will be there to be able to sort of reflect the different interests from different parts of the state, whether it's their economic justice issues, industry issues, and go through the things that are happening on underground injection and related issues, and be able to offer informed opinions and to be a touchstone, just the way you will be for us for the last 7 months, but for the next administration coming in. And so I think that the expectations were clear. So that's once again why I want to thank you for serving. I've appointed a couple where I convinced on the Blue Ribbon Commission for State Parks it wasn't going to last longer than a year, hear the number of meetings, and every time I'd go to a meeting in their third year, they would remind me of their initial commitment. And so I think that you understand what is involved in this, and I just really appreciate you bringing your time and your expertise and your interest to this, because it will be really valuable to everybody, and I wanted to just kick it off with that as welcoming remarks. So thanks for allowing me to be here at the beginning.
I thought the agenda had some other items on it before the panel kicked off. Okay. I guess we're on. Okay. So with that, I'll introduce Ken Harris, who's the state oil and gas supervisor.
Good afternoon. I'm Ken Harris, state oil and gas supervisor. I'm not actually an oil regulator. I'm actually a water regulator, but found myself in this job about 2.5 years ago. To my right is Justin Turner. Justin is the assistant chief counsel for the department. He's going to be, much like the basketball game last night, he's my color commentator. I'm going to do the basics, and then if you have questions I can't answer, then, or if we need to add a little additional information, then Justin will step in. Also, full disclosure, these are not my reading glasses, so if I seem to struggle reading things, you wouldn't I would forget my reading glasses on a day like today. So, one thing on the title slide, you'll notice it says Division of Oil, Gas, Geothermal Resources. It's commonly known as Dogger, and that's what I'm going to refer to it as during the presentation. It's interesting about California. When I came over, there was a lot about oil I did not know. In fact, I knew very little. And recently, I heard a statistic which surprised me just a few days ago, and that is if you look at cumulative oil production dating back to 1900, there's only one state that has produced more oil in California, and that is Texas. You hear a lot about the Dakotas and fracking and all that, but California still ranks as the number two oil-producing state over the production history of the United States. I thought that was pretty interesting. UIC, we have over 50,000 injection wells in California, which if you look at other states, that's a huge number. That is in part due to the age of our oil fields. They date back into the 1800s, as well as our geology. We have unique geology out here that other states don't have, and it requires injection wells to get the oil out. So today what we're going to cover, I'm going to give you a brief introduction to underground injection control. This is going to be very brief, and I'm sure you'll have a lot of questions. Put you on the slides for me. One of the things we'll do is, this is very brief, so going forward, even though Lawrence Berkeley Labs and Preston are going to be running the panel, if you have requests from us and information requests, we'll certainly work with Preston to try to get that information out to you. So brief introduction. Second, we're going to talk about some issues that have been identified in Dogger's administration of the program. That's kind of why SB 83 was passed and why we're here today. And then we'll talk about the science-based regulatory and performance reforms that are going on in Dogger and have been for a number of years. So it's the U.S. Safe Drinking Water Act that regulates UIC by the states or by the federal government. And fluid injection into the subsurface, Dogger received primacy for that through an MOA agreement with US EPA back in 1983. And what that means is Dogger regulates any class two well, which is a well that is used for enhanced oil recovery or production produced water disposal. The other aspect of the Safe Drinking Water Act, it's designed to protect California and other states' drinking water resources. Now, that may be kind of a rerun for some of you, but for some of you, that may be new information. We're going to talk about aquifers that are exempt. This has been a large part, a large workload for us over the last couple of years. And the Safe Drinking Water Act requires that we prevent underground injection that might endanger drinking water sources. Dogger, now working with the Water Board, the Water Board is our partner in this. We have to ensure that when you inject something into the subsurface, it stays where you inject it and where you intend to inject it, and that it does not contaminate or endanger other sources of drinking water. Now, there is criteria that we use and that EPA uses and the Water Board uses to make a determination whether or not an aquifer can be exempted. It cannot serve currently as a source of drinking water. It cannot now and will not in the future serve as a source of drinking water. Another test is it naturally contains hydrocarbons, oil or gas, and that it's economically or technologically practical to render the water that is in that aquifer fit for human consumption, or that the total dissolved solid, or TDS, is greater than 10,000 milligrams per liter, and it is not reasonably expected to supply a public drinking water source.
That's really just a two-part test there. It can be said more simply just by looking at the top two bullets on the slide that it's not currently a source of drinking water and it won't be a source of drinking water in the future. Those three sub-bullets are ways that you could show that water won't be a source of drinking water in the future.
I hope you skipped, you went too far.
I go too far.
Yep. It's missing a slide, or am I ahead of myself? UIC wells. Okay. So UIC wells are used, as I mentioned earlier, for two purposes. One is for enhanced oil recovery. The other is for disposal. In California, you'll find three flavors of enhanced oil. That's cyclic steam, steam flood, and water flood. And we'll show you some examples of these in a moment. And for disposal wells, produce water or gas for disposal. Injection wells have been an integral part of California's oil and gas operations for nearly 60 years. And that's mainly because once oil fields reach a certain age, you end up having to go to secondary or tertiary technologies to retrieve the oil. As I said earlier, there are approximately 55,000 oil field injection wells operating in California. These include enhanced oil recovery wells used to increase oil recovery through sustained injection or reinjection of large volumes of fluid, and wells devoted to the disposal of produced water that emerges from hydrocarbon deposits areas simultaneously and is commingled with the produced hydrocarbons. About 75% of the roughly 600,000 barrels of oil produced daily in California, 35% of California's daily petroleum use results from the use of EOR injection methods. Injection wells also function as disposal wells for the large volume of water that are drawn up along with the hydrocarbons. Due to the maturity of California's oil fields, every barrel of oil extracted from underground is commingled with over 15 barrels of water on average. After the oil is separated, operators must dispose of the immense volumes of water in order to continue the production process. Of the residual water, roughly two-thirds is returned to oil-bearing reservoirs for enhanced production and reservoir pressure balance. The remaining one-third may be cleaned and blended with other water for use in agriculture, support of critical habitat, or miscellaneous oil field use. Picture the next one. So this is a picture of one of ERA's oil fields, the Bell Ridge field. And if you look at it, you'll see pump jacks, but you'll also see injection wells, which don't have a pump jack. And I don't know for sure if this is steam or if it's cyclic steam or steam flood or water disposal. But that's a typical California oil field, at least in the San Joaquin. And you won't see something like this anywhere else in the nation. Today, what you find is, like in the Dakotas and even in the Permian Basin of Texas, what you see is they'll have a platform, an area, might be several acres in size, and they might have 30 wells on that area, and those go out and they turn and go laterally for sometimes up to 4 miles, and those are the fracking wells that produce immense amounts of oil. But that's not the way we do that in California. And again, that's partially because of the geology we have here. Go to the next slide. So this is a picture of what cyclic steam looks like. You inject steam, you turn the steam off, you let the heat diffuse, then you turn the pump jack on and you produce the oil. This is water flood, but it also could be called steam flood, putting water down and then just pumping that up on a continuous basis. And most of the time, if not always, that water that's injected is produced water, recovered water that's slightly treated and reinjected back into the oil-bearing zone. This is, again, a cartoon of bringing up oil, running it through a separator to separate the oil and the water, and then reinjecting that water back into the oil-bearing zone. And that does a couple of things, of course. One, it helps to flush the oil out, but in some cases it's needed to prevent subsidence. One comment about produced water in California, the TDS of water in California can range anywhere from 500 parts per million up to about 30, 35, 40,000 parts per million. Out in the Dakotas, where they're fracking shale, the TDS ranges as high as 250,000 parts per million. Our water is relatively fresh compared to other parts of the nation. This is a jar of oil water that sits on one of my cabinets, and I thought you'd be interested in seeing that. That came right out of a spigot on an oil well, but when it came up, it was warm, and it was an emulsion. It looked something like a chocolate milkshake, but if you let it set, then the oil and the water separate. And I was always kind of struck by how clear the water is and how well they separate if you give them enough time. I thought it's kind of an interesting something you might like to see. We're going to move on to the second group of topics, and that is some of the issues that have been identified in Dogger's regulation of the UIC program. So UIC, again, is regulated pursuant to the 1974 Drinking Water Act. Dogger gained primacy back in 1983, And when US EPA gave us primacy, of course, we committed to certain things. That primacy entailed certain responsibilities, primarily that we would require and oversee two-part mechanical integrity testing for injection wells. The reason you want to do that is you want to make sure, again, that the injected fluid goes where it's supposed to and the well isn't leaking off into areas where you don't want it to go to. Evaluation of other wells within what we call an area of review around the injection well prior to approval of the project. And again, you want to make sure in that case, the primary reason is to make sure that those wells have integrity so that you don't short circuit the system when you're pumping produced water down. You don't want it to travel over to another well, travel up that well bore, and then leak out into an area where you don't want it to leak out into. And then protection of underground sources of drinking water via zonal isolation, making sure the water goes where it's supposed to, making sure the water stays where it goes to.
I'd just say the federal law, the Safe Drinking Water Act, is not the source of Dogger's authority. Dogger has authorities right under state law and the various public resources code statutes and has promulgated its own regulations. And those are the authorities that Dogger implements. The primacy agreement is an agreement to exercise those state authorities in a way that will affect the purposes of the Safe Drinking Water Act to protect USDWs as defined by US EPA. And what we get in return for that is the US EPA leaves the state alone to regulate oil and gas operations.
So in 2011, US EPA did an audit of our program. There's a whole list of bullets there of what they found. You see a lot of inconsistent and you see inadequate. So we had a number of issues that we needed to address. In 2014, the Water Board and Dogger discovered that there were wells permitted that were injecting into non-exempted aquifers. They were aquifers that were historically treated as exempt. Then there were permits issued into what are called step-out areas, and I'll show you a nice diagram of that. So we had inappropriately permitted wells. So this is an example of one of the, there were a number of issues. This is an example of a list of historically exempted aquifers. The list on the left was one, they had the same date, same cover letter. The one on the left was at headquarters, and the one on the right was in Bakersfield, or what we call inland now. The underline are those that are in addition on the Bakersfield list that we did not have on the headquarters list. They did not reconcile the two lists. Now, this is the diagram,
and
you have
a question.
Okay, sure.
Sort of a trick question. Is there a difference between aquifers historically treated as exempt and exempt?
At this point, the issue of the discrepancy between the two lists has been resolved. There were the ones that were exempt on the longer list. Since then, the state's gone through a public process and worked with US EPA to clarify that those are not exempt aquifers, with one small exemption, one small part of one of those aquifers went through the aquifer exemption process and was formally exempted. The term historically treated as exempt was a term of art that we were all using to refer to those aquifers where it wasn't quite clear what the status was for them.
So you have this handout, which is where this slide came from, and the reason I gave you this handout is because this slide's of poor quality, but I wanted to show it to you. It comes from what are known as California oil and gas fields. There are three volumes which describe some basic facts about each of the oil fields, and it is these upon which oil production is carried out in California, including those areas where wells are allowed and not allowed. And you can see back in, this actually was updated, volume one was updated in 1998, but you can still see that it's pretty basic. A lot of hand-drawn diagrams that go back, many, many years. And if we go to the next slide, the same, this is a more up-to-date diagram of that same image. And this was, I believe, came from one of the aquifer exemption packages that was produced and was submitted to EPA. And I think it says it was also approved by EPA for the Pozo Creek. See, my glasses are failing me. For Pozo Creek oil field. And the step-out area that we're talking about, where wells have gone beyond the original boundaries, is that light line, gray line, is the originally exempted area. And then you can see there's a number of producing wells and injection wells that have kind of creeped out beyond that original boundary. Now, the thick green line is the new exempted area that was recently approved by EPA. But this is the kind of thing that we have been working through and trying to rectify. So when you look at the, we started looking at these, we found three different groups of wells. Wells that were injecting into zones that had TDS less than 3,000. And they were shut in through voluntary compliance, orders by Dogger, and emergency regulations back in 2015-2016. There were wells that were injecting into non-hydrocarbon zones having a TDS of 10,000 milligrams per liter, and they didn't appear to meet the criteria for exemption. So those were shut in also during that same time period. And then there are wells that were injecting into zones where scientific evidence indicated that the aquifer exemption were in a current application, and that we felt that they stood a good chance of being ultimately approved. We allowed those to remain in operation. The last area we're going to talk about is the science-based regulatory and program reforms that we are carrying out in Dogger. And two primary areas are our renewal plan and new regulations. In 2015, US EPA accepted our plan for full compliance with the Safe Drinking Water Act. Through evaluation of permitted projects, shut-in of appropriately approved wells, aquifer exemptions, adoption of new UIC regulations, and creation of new data management system. So the first topic is the renewal plan, and four primary aspects of it is we were striving to modernize our regulatory oversight, modernize our regulatory framework, modernize our data management, and modernize the workforce. So modernizing the regulatory oversight, Dogger's currently conducting comprehensive assessment of all approved UIC projects. We call that project by project, and that entails over 1,000 projects. We're reviewing all Class 2 wells, injection wells, to ensure that they're in compliance with the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act. When it comes to the project-by-project review, we've established six criteria that we're using to prioritize those. As you can imagine, going through 1,000 projects is going to take us several years to do. We want to look at those that pose the greatest risk to the public health, the environment, and to sources of drinking water. So TDS of the native aquifer is important. The lower the TDS, the higher the risk. We want to protect those low TDS sources of water. Depth of injection zone, of course, if it's shallower, it's going to be a higher risk. Type of injection well, disposal ranked higher than EOR. Disposal, you're just getting rid of it, and as some of the pictures we showed you earlier, if you're doing EOR, you're putting water in, but you're also going to pull that out. You have somewhat of a close cycle to work with. Age of the wells, older wells considered higher risk than newer wells. Proximity to urban areas, closer is a higher risk. And proximity to municipal drinking water source wells, closer, again, is a higher risk.
The next is modernizing our regulatory framework. We are almost ready to send our UIC regulations, brand new UIC regulations, over to the Office of Administrative Law. Improvements to the UIC regs will ensure groundwater protection, improve industry standards, and boost data collection. We're also standing up a new program, an idle well program, and revisions to idle well requirements and those regulations will further protect groundwater and limit potential for risk by encouraging, I guess is the best way to say, encouraging the oil industry to get rid of wells that have been around for a long, long time and have of no other viable use to the industry but pose a threat to the environment. One thing about the regulatory, the regs, as well as the regulatory framework, we're looking at this as an entire package, not in a silo manner, more holistic fashion. An example is every step of the way in our regs, we engage the national labs several times during the development process. And one of the reasons we do that is some of the older regs didn't have a scientific basis for some of the requirements they had in there. And going forward, one of the things we want to strive for, if we put a number in there for a setback or something else, we want to make sure that we can justify that not only to industry, but we're confident that that is going to be protective, for example. And we've carried that methodology across all of our regulations, including our gas storage program, UIC, idle testing. And an example of that is the way we do pressure tests. So we went back to the national labs, and we did this originally for the gas storage regs, and we said, we want some help with this. We can't find any what's normally presented by industry, and this is all around the country. There's no scientific basis. We can't find why this number came about. So we worked with them to produce something that we were confident with and that they also felt was safe. And then that standard now you'll see across all of our regs where any kind of testing is required. So idle well testing is not going to be different than UIC, and it's not going to be different than gas storage. And that's an appropriate thing to do across all those wells. As we develop these regs, we've included all the stakeholders, industry, NGOs, national labs. We've looked at other states. We've tried to be as inclusive as possible. Of course, that doesn't mean that we've made everybody happy, but we have listened to everyone in developing the regs. We also are committed to revisiting those regs. The technology in the oil fields is changing very, very quickly, and many of the original regs date back decades, haven't been touched in years. Our goal going forward is to make sure when it's appropriate that we will revise those regs. And an example is the well stimulation regulations, which are only a couple of years old. But in working with industry and doing some research, we've determined that there are some aspects of those regs that need to be updated. So at some point, we will be going out for a second rulemaking to update those regulations. So the framework, modernizing the framework, updating UIC regulations. As I said, we're looking for December 28th to complete those. And areas of improvement are how we look at the area review, more robust mechanical integrity testing, comprehensive project data requirements, specific regulations for surface expression, greater transparency for maximum allowable surface pressures, greater consistency and transparency on fluid analysis, tubing and packer requirements, and water quality protection criteria. On data management, Secretary Laird mentioned our new data system. We are now about 3 years into that system, and what we did was we took what other states were using, 23 other states, which have been using a system that was developed by the Groundwater Protection Council, and we basically took it apart and are putting it back together, and it'll be, when it is done, it'll be the most modern comprehensive data system in the nation. We are now, just at the end of April, we had our second release out of four, and that second release was UIC. There are some additional releases for the next release will also contain some UIC elements. And the next slide will give you kind of an overview of what that release looks like. And each of those releases underneath are the components that it contains. And in fact, this system is so advanced, we're putting this into the cloud, that other states are now looking at using the system. Texas has been out several times to look at this and have stated that they would like to use our system. Of course, it would have to be modified for them slightly. North Dakota is adopting this system, and other states are looking at it in whole or part. Modernizing the workforce, we've established a technical training coordinator and an office of training. We currently are budgeted for $1 million a year training budget, and we're using every cent of it. What we want to make sure is we want to make sure that our people are as smart as the industry's folks and that they are as up-to-date as the industry folks. We've partnered with the University of Texas, Austin, Penn State, University of Colorado School of Mines to help provide some of that training, and we are developing our own curriculum also. And then finally, looking forward, this year's governor's budget contains a little over $1 million to kick off an office of enforcement. This is important because Dogger, as a regulatory agency, as far as I know, is the only regulatory agency in the state that did not have some sort of office of enforcement. And I think it's good for industry, it's good for us, it's good for the state. We want to make sure that industry, for example, they all have, they're all on an equal playing field. They don't have someone who is getting financial gain from not following the rules while other folks are. And we want to make sure that those are not who are not following the rules, that we bring them back in compliance. And compliance really is the key. It's not out there writing tickets, making money. What we want is we want to make sure that people are in compliance and that they're following the regs. We also have $4.25 million for 21 additional field inspectors. We have a lot of work to do, and even though we've grown considerably, there's still a need for staff to implement the new regs and the new requirements that we have. So at this point, this concludes our presentation, and I'll turn it back to Preston Jordan, who, with the assistance of the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, will facilitate and support this review panel. Even though we don't have, after this, any formal role in this process, we do stand ready to assist you in any way we can. If we can answer questions or provide materials, we certainly will do so. Thank you.
Thank you, Supervisor Harris. And to step in, I made a facilitator's decision, which led to some confusion about rearranging the agenda, just so that everybody knows what's going on. I thought it would be actually better flow to have the agencies do their presentations, and then we could go into our introductions and discussions rather than mixing the two together. So that's why y'all haven't spoken yet. But of course, if you do have questions during the agency presentations, as Mr. Anderson already did, please jump in and ask, because it's a good opportunity to get information. Of course, it's not the last one. So with that, I would like to introduce John Berkovich of the State Water Resources Control Board. And I'm not sure, John, at this point, is your title, are you head of GAMMA, or I don't know where you're at now?
That's part of what I'm doing.
But part of it.
Here we go. Well, good afternoon, everyone. My name is John Borkovich. I'm the Groundwater Monitoring Section Chief, which includes the GAMMA unit, the Groundwater Ambient Monitoring and Assessment Unit, as well as two units overseeing our oil and gas groundwater monitoring efforts. So today, I'm just going to be providing some real high-level slides. In fact, I'm probably going to skip through a few of these since Kim's presentation was very thorough and comprehensive, but it might not hurt just to briefly mention some of the background with respect to the water boards. I work for the State Water Board, and there are 9 regional water quality control boards. The bulk of the oil production in California comes from the Central Valley Region 5, that's highlighted in blue, as well as our LA Regional Board and Central Coast Regional Board, and there is some activity in the Santa Ana region, Region 8. Our historical collaboration with Dogger became more formalized in 1988 with the Memorandum of agreement, and that's our role split with respect to the disposition of produced water in general and the permitting associated with it to not have dual permitting process to avoid that. So the surface portion of that is overseen through a regulatory process, our waste discharge requirement permits through the regional water quality control boards, as well as our review with Dogger on UIC project permitting. Of course, our increase in awareness with respect to our role became more apparent and associated in 2013, by SB 4, where the board adopted, was directed by the legislation to adopt what's called a model criteria for groundwater monitoring. Also, we worked with Dogger on the identification of those wells that were injecting outside of the currently exempted areas, as well as the work associated on SB 83, in particular pond permitting, and our contribution to that report with respect to identification of resources and so forth. And right now, for your information, if you haven't heard already, the revision to the 1988 MOA is posted on our website for a 30-day public comment period. Subsequent to that public comment period, there will be a board meeting, state board meeting, held in late July, which will give our executive director the authority to sign the MOA. So just briefly going over what our role is in general with oil and gas in California, our underground injection control work associated working with Dogger with our regional boards on the review of UIC projects. Those are for new and modifications, as well as the project-by-project reviews that are coming up. Aquifer exemption proposal review and feedback that ends with a typically with a, what we call a concurrence letter. Also, our role with well stimulation through SB4, produced water ponds, as well as produced water reuse and food safety that our regional board oversees in the Central Valley. So once again, just to repeat, we co-review the UIC projects with Dogger. Our main focus is on injected fluids remaining in the areas that they're supposed to stay in the protection of future and current beneficial use waters. Since 2014, we've reviewed 85 projects for hundreds of UIC wells, and oftentimes our regional boards and state board conditions on those projects are usually for additional monitoring to verify containment. Our aquifer exemption proposal review process is we receive the package from Dogger that works with the operators to produce the package. We have a review process where we ask questions. Oftentimes there's amendments to the aquifer exemption proposal. Then when we get to a point where we're in agreement, we issue a preliminary concurrence letter that triggers a public comment period. There's a public hearing that's co-hosted by Dogger and the water boards. And then once the public comments are collated, we get that package from Dogger, review that, and then it gets finalized by putting together the package that Dogger sends to the US EPA. So far, we've received 35 aquifer exemption proposals. We've completed 21 of those. Two are currently under review, and there's still 12 with Dogger for additional information. So with our concurrence, there are limitations and conditions. I think that a way in which you think about a limitation versus what a condition is that a limitation is somewhat of a restriction on our ability or our concurrence. So we wouldn't want that activity to occur at all, whereas a condition is on a case-by-case basis at the project level. So when we're reviewing a UIC project, a condition could be requested to be implemented in a project approval from Dogger. And most of this circles around the demonstration of containment of injected fluids in the intended zone. And that concludes my presentation. I'll be available for questions throughout the hearing, and if you have any questions now, I'd be happy to answer them.
John, can you explain the relationship between the state board and the regional boards?
So there's many ways to answer that question. So the, I think a real, you know, high level point of view is that we're the adjudicative branch. We issue water rights as well as manage the programs at the state level. Also, if there's a petition on a permit, it is sent to the state board for review. That's our historical role, and that the regional boards are responsible for permitting activities as well as enforcement on those permits as necessary.
Are there any other questions?
We got one. So could you say a little bit more about the type of monitoring that y'all require?
So for the most part, we're talking about information regarding quality of the injectate, quality of the injection zone, as well as potential monitoring for pressures. There haven't been any specific groundwater monitoring, traditional type of groundwater monitoring associated with a UIC project review, but that is on the table. There have been some movements in that respect for one aquifer's exemption in particular. So we're looking at using our ability to be able to look at actual groundwater data quality and levels to help to indicate whether or not the fluids are staying within the intended zone.
Yeah, John, how you doing? How are you feeling about the review time that it's taking to get through this process? I mean, we've been down a long road together. Is it, in your opinion, are we getting? Seems like we're getting better at it. Would you share that view?
Well, I think so. I believe that if you're referring specifically to the aquifer exemptions, I think that we're making progress, good progress with Dogger on the review of those. It was a little bit bumpy at first, frankly, but as we've gotten better at it, I guess, it's gone a lot more smoothly.
John, Juan Flores here. For the reuse of produced water and food safety, what type of monitoring and how often is that being done?
So I'm not an expert in answering that question, except that that activity is being regulated at our Central Valley Regional Water Quality Control Board level in conjunction with the permittee. So there are two permits in particular that, if you're referring to the Kern River field, the water that's being reused by Koala Water District, so there are waste discharge requirements associated with both of those. So there is some treatment of that produced water, but as was indicated earlier by Supervisor Harris, there is a very low level of TDS in the water, in particular on the east side of the San Joaquin Valley, where the water boards feel that the, you know, try to encourage water reuse where appropriate and if it's safe. And so I think that the thrust of the, or the review panel for the food safety group is looking at that level of it. We don't have expertise with respect to if the food is safe to eat or not, so that's why they convene that panel. But as far as the actual activity itself, it is monitored and as part of the permit requirement for testing.
Right. I have a question. So I noticed one of the conditions was that the quality of the water that's injected, and I think it was in enhanced oil recovery projects, but I'm not sure B, equal to or better than the water that's in the zone already. And that seemed to be without regard to the TDS of that water.
Actually, it is primarily due to the TDS. So if the area in particular is an oil-bearing zone that has good quality water in it, we're asking that that injectate be equal or better quality.
Okay, that that was
the focus being on TDS, but potentially for other chemicals. Like, for instance, borons. Boron is one in particular that is of interest because of its impact on crops.
And so does that condition hold no matter what the TDS of the formation water is? I mean, if it's 20,000 TDS, does that condition still get applied to the projects? Or is
so
it really
far, that applicability, we haven't looked at it specifically at that, but it's been primarily focused on areas where it's good quality injection zone water quality.
Which would be less than 10,000 TDS? Or
yeah.
How's that? Okay. Thank you. Are there any other questions?
I'm just interested in hearing a little more. I understand that the intent of the UIC program and the aquifer exemptions is to ensure that the fluids are injected or stay in the zone that they're injected into, and that that zone contains water that is of an appropriate quality to be injecting into. I'm just curious how you look at the potential for connectivity to other aquifers that might be of differing quality.
Right, so that's something that goes into our review process. So the zone that it's intended to go into, it should be in that package. And if it's insufficient information within either the aquifer exemption proposal or a UIC project, then we work with Doggard to make sure that it does before any approval potential concurrence associated with those projects occur. So we wouldn't agree with a project if it wasn't clear where the fluids were going.
Can you just explain a little more the scientific process of trying to make that evaluation of whether there is any connectivity?
Sure. There's geologic cross-sections. There are well construction diagrams, stratigraphic information. There's permeability, other types of scientific information, the quality of the injectate, the quality of the injection zone. It's a pretty comprehensive review that our staff undertake either at the regional board and or at the state board to work with Doggard to ensure that all of our questions are answered before a project gets approved.
Yeah, can I ask a question? This might be more appropriate for Supervisor Harris. With regards to the well database that is being developed, I noticed there was a bullet on 2019 for public access. Is it the intention that that will be a publicly available database?
Yes.
And all components of it, or will there remain a proprietary component?
Unless there's a trade secret. I mean, California is a state that prides itself on transparency, so unless there is something that passes the legal test to keep it private,
so the intention
it will all
is
be available.
Yeah, thanks. Okay, and then in general, are the presentations that are being given going to be available to the panel members?
Certainly.
Yes. Okay. Thank you.
So I wanted, this is maybe a question for one or both of you. I wanted to know, just have a little bit more clarity on exactly what criteria you use when determining aquifer exemption. So I understand that TDS, you know, under 10,000 is one of the criteria. You also mentioned presence of hydrocarbons. To what degree would you permit, say, a disposal well, class 2D well, or you know EOR, if there is some hydrocarbons in there, but not you know an economically recoverable amount?
I think we'd need more information than what you just provided. One thing that's quite different than in the past is when you look at these aquifer exemption packages, they can be this thick and they can be thousands of pages with analysis and cross-sections. So they're pretty rigorous. The criteria that I mentioned are those are the ones that we go by that are in federal regs, but what supports the determination is about this thick, and it is on a case-by-case basis. Rarely in nature do you find black and white decisions. They're always kind of gray, and so part of it is a judgment. We take the information we have, we make the best assessment, we sit around the table with the water board and with the operators, we try to fill in any gaps that we have, and then we make a call.
So I'd like to just throw in there too, to piggyback on what Ken just said, was that the you know, there have been cases where the water boards have received the package and we haven't concurred with a portion of it. So I think that the questions that you're asking are the same questions that we ask. And so if we feel that we can't concur with it, we won't. And in cases where we do concur, oftentimes we require that there be monitoring to ensure that it's not migrating out of that intended zone and that it meets the minimum criteria. So there's the federal criteria, and then there's the state criteria.
And I will suggest that if you would like at some point, and I'll look over to Preston, I mean, we could always also do a presentation sometime for you on a, say, an aquifer exemption proposal. If you would like a slideshow, we typically provide those for EPA on every package. It may not answer all your questions, but it'll at least, I think, help you understand the thought process and the data that goes into doing those.
Be for John. You mentioned that currently there's not a push for the groundwater monitoring for water quality. What do you see that changing a little bit in the future?
So I think maybe to amend what I said earlier, if you will, I mean, we're looking at groundwater monitoring through our regional groundwater monitoring effort with the U.S. Geological Survey, and that's relatable to the work through our model criteria. So there is groundwater monitoring occurring at that level in many of these same areas. In those cases, there is a requirement that the operator do groundwater monitoring. Specifically, it's associated with well stimulation, but there's also other groundwater data available in many circumstances, but there are significant data gaps in those areas. So we're bit by bit filling in those data gaps in you know, collaboration with the U.S. Geological Survey. However, with respect to UIC specifically, there's only one case so far where we're working with the operator to do a more significant traditional groundwater monitoring effort associated with that aquifer exemption proposal. But what we're looking at in many of the other cases are to rely upon existing infrastructure, other types of monitoring to ensure that the inject date stays within the zone that it's intended to go in. But it doesn't take groundwater monitoring off the table. It's going to be something that will be a decision in collaboration with Dogger at the project level. If it necessitates groundwater monitoring, we're going to advocate that we do groundwater monitoring in those circumstances. So a blanket groundwater monitoring in every circumstance is not something that we're entertaining at this point, but we certainly will advocate for it and push for it to happen on a case-by-case basis at the project level.
I have a question about...
Sorry about that. I was going to take Brianna next. I apologize. I'm not doing a good job here. I'm trying to watch people's hands get raised and let them know they've been raised. So, Jan, you'll be after Brianna. Okay.
Thanks. So injection has been occurring into some of these wells, you know, for years or decades into non-exempt aquifers. So to what extent or what steps have been taken to determine the extent to which that improper injection may have changed an aquifer that perhaps previously would not have been eligible for an exemption, you know, because of the improper injection that occurring is perhaps now available for one? Have steps been taken to try and determine what the historic quality of these aquifers were before the improper injection occurred?
So in the case where we're pursuing a groundwater monitoring plan with a proposed aquifer exemption, that's something that is on the table. But specifically making, you know, like a blanket statement, how we're going to approach these is, you know, I think, you know, we really are handling this on a case-by-case basis. So if there is a situation where it would appear potentially that the water quality was better and now it's been degraded, I think we really have to not speculate on a kind of hypothetical level here. Because when we've had these similar types of discussions with Dogger and with others about it, the UIC regulations are clear in that the quality of the injection zone currently is how we approach that threshold for water quality. So I think that, you know, we're certainly concerned about it. The migration out of the zone of where it's intended to go is utmost important to us, and degradation of water quality is something that we're significantly concerned about. However, I think making kind of a blanket, you know, statement is not appropriate.
If I could take the liberty of a follow-up question, if you'll humor me, are you aware of any aquifer exemption applications that were based on quality in the zone as it was due to disposal of water into that zone, that maybe it was historically treated as exempt but not exempt? In other words, are there any zones where there was so much disposal that it actually changed the quality of the water throughout the entire zone?
I think another way of answering that question is that it's clear from especially the larger fields, like I'll use a specific example, Midway Sunset. You've got shallow injection that's been occurring, you know, from through EOR and by disposal, and you had water quality of a certain level before any of those activities occurred back in the early 1900s. So to be able to go back in the time machine and figure out what the water quality was in Area A is problematic. Really, the data are disparate. It's not something that you can consistently say across the board that, hey, this activity caused this. There are areas where there's naturally occurring high TDS water, next to areas where there's low TDS water, and it's possible that the low TDS water was introduced through aqueduct water that was used for steam. So what we're looking at it more on what it is right now basis.
Thank you. Next is Jan. Thanks for patience.
This is probably for Ken. I was curious about when you have these injection wells, the disposal wells, for instance, and you're disposing of this water hourly, all the time, constantly, how do you monitor that to be sure that it doesn't spike above the fracture gradient of the formation? Is there a continual monitoring going on with that, or do they come out and check it occasionally?
Yes. So the pressure at which they can inject is in their permit, and that is something that Dogger is responsible for observing. There are cases where we have gone back and told people to dial it back because they're putting it in above what we consider a safe pressure. That is something we dictate and monitor.
Dan's next.
Thank you. I think this is for both of you. Supervisor Harris, in your presentation, you described the Safe Drinking Water Act criteria for potential sources of drinking water, and one of those cited 10,000 parts per million TDS.
Or less.
And then, John, in the state's Resolution 8863, Sources of Drinking Water, in a parallel construction to what the federal guidelines have, it lists 3,000 parts per million TDS or less as a potential source of drinking water. In the work that you guys are doing and looking forward to, I see a lot of confusion in this in practice about, you know, what the relative significance of the California definition versus the federal definition, and are they even the same things? Do you guys have some thoughts you could share with us on that question?
Trying to think about what you're actually asking. So you're correct in your observation. If it's over 10,000, then it's not a source of drinking water. But that doesn't mean necessarily that, for example, the Water Board might not consider it. The Water Board has taken, a very progressive view of sources of drinking water in the future, thinking that you don't know what technology will bring. We don't know what we will need in terms of water resources in the future with droughts. I always say that people, you'd be surprised what people will drink. Depends on how thirsty they are. And so we've always looked at, or the Water Board is always, it's always been 10,000 or less with, and it gets complicated. So again, to give you a simple answer is going to be difficult. It's going to, how we treat an aquifer with 8,700 TDS is going to depend on a lot of factors. Is there oil in it? Is there not oil? What are they proposing to inject into it? Is it higher or not? What do our friends at the Water Board think about that, and what are they going to impose in terms of condition? So it's, again, it's a case-by-case situation. The 3,000 is something that's more sensitive, and as I stated in my presentation, where we found that people were injecting into those, we shut those down, or required they shut those injectors down if they were injecting into 3,000 TDS or less water. But between 3,000 and 10,000, then it gets more difficult, and it really is a case-by-case situation.
So since you asked both of us, so I think I might answer the question a little bit differently in that at the beginning of our, you know, or the renaissance, if you will, of our renewal for reviewing oil and gas projects back in 2013 or so, I agree with you that it appears that there seems to be quite a bit of confusion associated with what you described in your question. And what we looked at was just making it clear of what our concern was. And we've come up with this definition called protected water. And that is for water that's below 10,000. So there are many beneficial uses of water for people that are not just for drinking water purposes. So the 3,000 levels for drinking water purposes from a municipal water supply. However, there are many beneficial uses of water that occur above the 3,000 threshold that could be used. So we identified those as being necessary to be protected.
Laura.
Actually, I had a follow-up on Jan's question, and then now I sort of have a follow-up on Dan's question, too, so maybe I can just get a twofer. But first, I just wanted to ask, Jan was asking about, do you monitor for whether the pressure ever exceeds the fracture gradient of the rock? And you said that you do. But as I recall, when the CCST and LBNL team looked at the data that Dogger was collecting on injection pressure in the UIC wells back in 2014, 2015 or so, the data was reported by the operators as monthly averages. And the conclusion was that that was not enough resolution to fully understand the impacts of the injection. Has the data collection changed in some way to allow more resolution on that information?
I don't have an answer for you on that. I can get back to you on that if you'd like.
That'd be great. And then my other follow-up question. I was just interested, you were saying, John, you were saying that the Water Board has defined protected water as less than 10,000 TDS and less than 3,000 as a source of drinking water for municipal uses. Where is that? Is that written in regulation? Where is that actually written out? I'm just interested in hearing where it's.
It's part of either a policy or regulation or law that's in the water code. I don't know specifically.
Okay.
I'd have to get back to you on that.
Okay, so it comes somewhere from, but we don't quite know the source. Okay.
But sources of drinking water. Yeah.
Can I answer a little bit of that question? It might help you a little bit. You can't be delegated from EPA anything that has a less stringent policy or guidance. So actually the 10,000 parts per million is what has to be regulated as Safe Drinking Water Act protected waters. So actually both Ken and John were trying to say the same thing. The 3,000 was in the state water code, and for a long time people thought that that was okay, but in actuality, if you go back to the regulations and the delegation of the Safe Drinking Water Act, because it was delegated, then you had to protect the 10,000. I just thought that would help you a little bit.
So the 3,000, you'll find it in the sources of drinking water policy. And I think that's resolution 6816, but it's been a while since I looked at it, so.
I had a question, John, from your presentation. I mentioned that the Water Board's been involved in reviewing 85 projects. Mm-hmm. Are those new project approvals, or are those looking at existing projects? I know it's, you know, on the agenda to go through and do project reviews across the board for every existing ones. I'm curious what that was.
That was strictly looking at either a new or a modification of an existing project.
And has the division or the Water Board begun the process of doing reviews of existing projects yet?
We have, but we're just now gearing up. There's a couple of things going on. One is the staff resources that have gone into aquifer exemptions has been heavy. Those are slowly starting to get freed up. Also, the MOU that John talked about has an appendix, and in that appendix is a checklist of data that we agreed on must be by law, and if it's something additional that the Water Board wanted, that checklist provides that so that they know that every package contains that. Along with that is a process roadmap so that it's transparent to the operators and to the public exactly how we are reviewing and processing those exemptions. So that's now in place. We're using it even though it hasn't been adopted or signed by all of us yet. But that is in place going forward.
So Mike Nicholas could correct me if I'm wrong here, but my memory and understanding is that most states, as a safety factor, I guess, when it comes to limiting the injection pressure, most states write into their permits that anywhere from a 70% to a 90% approach. And I'm curious what California's approach to the safety.
We do the same thing. I don't know what the exact percentage is, but it's like 75, 80, somewhere in that range. There is a safety margin built into all permits that allow injection.
That's usually based on either an instantaneous shut-in pressure or a step rate test.
Yes, Gustavo.
For Dauber's new kind of division of enforcement, would that body be like looking at historic data or analysis on any underground injection wells or permits that potentially might be near drinking water sources to start like comprehensive monitoring of the water quality and like potential of contaminating local drinking waters, if there is any? So the question is, would this body be potentially looking at enhanced or more equipped water monitoring, on the quality other than the TDS?
So that office is just getting started. We got 6 positions from the legislature this year. There, needless to say, is a lot of work to do, and each case is, if you can imagine a private detective who goes out and investigates a crime, it's rather staff and time intensive to build a legal case that will hold up in court. And so that means the attorneys and the technical staff have to do a lot of field work and a lot of research to do that. Right now, our focus is going to be on those immediate current issues, and the priority, of course, will go to anything that threatens the environment or public health first. Anything else will be dealt with as resources become available.
Yeah, Janet, go ahead.
Didn't push it hard enough. Aquifers. And one of them was much longer than the other. And I was reading the documentation we were sent, and there was 11 aquifers, I think, that had some kind of consternation associated with were they exempt or not. Were those 11 aquifers on the longer list and not in the shorter list? In other words, is the discrepancy between the two lists due to those 11 aquifers? And are they now exempt or are they now not exempt?
That's two or three questions, I think.
Sorry.
So that predates me, and I'm not the expert. I don't know if Justin wants to. Yeah, I'll let Justin answer that one.
Yeah, hi. So the 11 that were on the second list, at this point there has been a state public process, and the state's worked with US EPA to clarify that those 11 aquifers are not exempt. There was a lot of debate about, based on the ambiguous documentation, whether they were or they weren't. They were evaluated as to whether they should be, there was a process undertaken to clarify that they're not. With the exception of part of one of those aquifers actually did meet the criteria, and there was an aquifer exemption proposal that was moved through the public process and formally approved by EPA, so it was part of one of those 11 that actually is exempt now through a contemporary aquifer exemption process. And I think you also asked about whether that was the root of the issues as far as the step-outs and all of the need for aquifer exemptions throughout the state. And the answer is it was only a small part of the problem, really. There was some injection occurring in some of those 11 aquifers. Beyond that, there was the step-out issue that Ken had some maps showing some examples of. And that's, you know, there's, and John mentioned, I think, about 30 proposals that have been being developed by the state and are in various states of being proposed or being approved or being developed. Those are all broader issues than the confusion about those 11 aquifers.
One of the things that I might mention, and this may help the panel a little bit, this is not an issue that is unique to California. If you go back and read the GAO report on the UIC program nationwide, California recognized that they had not implemented the program in the way that other people thought that they should have, but none of the states had implemented the program in the way that people thought they should. And California, through the IOGCC and some other groups, had gotten together and they had discussed the issues for many years in trying to implement the program. It's not an easy program to implement correctly. And so when we're here today thinking about this, I think it's important to recognize that each reservoir is unique, each situation is different, and that's why it's taking a long time to move these aquifer exemptions through the process and why it's taking great consideration. But in that same GAO report, California was complimented on their recognition of the problem earlier than the other states. So I think our regulators deserve some credit in the recognition of the problem and how they are going about implementing, trying to solve it.
And if I can just add on, I think we, based on recent conversations at IOGCC, I think California will be, if not the first, one of the first states to complete the aquifer exemption review. Some haven't even started.
Any other questions? All right, with that, I think we'll move on to our next speaker. Thank you very much, Ken and John.
Can I make a motion for a 5-minute break?
I'd open
it.
I don't think we need a second for that. That's probably a good idea. All right. So we'll come back in 5 minutes. Thanks. All right, it looks like we're just missing one panelist. He's racing forward to his chair now. Thank you all for reconvening. And with that, I'd like to introduce Mike Nicholas, if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
You did.
Okay, very good. I know there's a lot of ways to pronounce that. So, and he's with the Groundwater Protection Council, and as you know, the Groundwater Protection Council is reviewing the state's processes for UIC permitting currently, kind of on a parallel track to this panel. Hi, Mike.
Thank you very much. A little background on the Groundwater Protection Council. We started out in 1983 as the Underground Injection Practices Council. So as you can see, that's our basic background to begin with is underground injection control. We changed in 1992 to the Groundwater Protection Council because we started looking at a more holistic approach to groundwater protection overall. We started getting into things like pesticides and getting into aquifer storage and recovery and other things like that. But basically, we're the association of the state groundwater protection and underground injection control agencies. So the Dogger folks are members of ours, as is the Water Board. In fact, Ken Harris and John Bishop are both members of our Board of Directors. So this process that we're going to be going through with Dogger and the Water Board is sort of what we like to think of as a reboot of a process that we used to do years ago. We had done something on the order of 15 or so underground injection control peer reviews in the past, California being one of those, but that was a very long time ago. And in the intervening years, of course, there's been a lot of changes in underground injection control, not only with respect to the technical aspects of it, but with respect to the legal aspects and administrative aspects as well. So we've done this reboot, and we have redesigned the questionnaire and the process somewhat so that it is more comprehensive in terms of what it's covering on the underground injection control program. And let me just be a little more specific about that. As most of you are probably aware, over the last several years, the state of Oklahoma, the state of Arkansas, Ohio, and others have had issues with what is commonly referred to as induced seismicity. That is seismicity that has been induced by human activity, most notably underground injection. And so when we put together this new program, we included aspects of induced seismicity in that discussion. We also included aspects of injection that is related to hydraulic fracturing, but only that is related to hydraulic fracturing when diesel is used, because that is the EPA's basic premise on whether it qualifies as underground injection control program or not, is whether diesel is used. So we've included that in this process as well. There are two basic kinds of reviews that are done typically of underground injection control programs, type or the class two programs. The first is EPA's oversight inspections. Ms. Wilson noted the GAO report. Obviously, there are some issues with respect to that oversight inspection process that EPA is trying to work out because of staffing and other issues. But the point is that their process is designed to review a state program to determine whether or not it is meeting its primacy requirements. That is, in the primacy package that was submitted and approved by EPA, is the state doing what they said they would do under primacy? Our process is quite different. Our process is more along the lines of a subjective evaluation based on the expertise of our team members as to whether or not the program is effective in protecting underground sources of drinking water as an underground injection control program. For California, we have several team members. Normally, we only have a couple of team members, but because of the size of the California program and the complexity of the program, we've added additional team members. Our team members for the California review include geologists and professional engineers from Class 2 programs from the states of Montana and Indiana and Michigan, as well as Dr. Mark Lane, who is one of the original designers of the risk-based data management system that California is working on right now. And he will be doing the IT portion of this review. We also have a facilitator who helps us run the review. That's his name's John Taylor. John is a former US EPA employee. He worked in the US EPA for 35 years in underground ingestion control in both Regions 5 and Region 4 in Atlanta. I am the GWPC representative. My background is I'm a geologist, professional geologist. Prior to working with the Groundwater Protection Council, I was the state oil and gas director in Indiana and worked for that program for nearly 20 years. So I ran the underground ingestion control program in Indiana, as well as enforcement compliance programs and permitting programs in that state. So the process essentially is a fairly simple one. We sent a questionnaire to Dogger, and they have worked with the Water Board to complete that questionnaire. That questionnaire should be coming back to us very soon. I will distribute that to the team members along with the current regulations and your proposed regulations for underground ingestion control, as well as the memorandum of agreement between Dogger and the Water Board. They will review those documents and will prepare follow-up questions, which will be asked at an interview which will be conducted between the 19th and the 21st of this month in Dogger's offices, and that will have members of Dogger and the Water Board present. We also invite other folks. Typically, Environmental Defense Fund has been invited. Unfortunately, they cannot attend this time. Region 9, the US EPA office, has an invitation to send an observer to the process. The team members will ask the questions, and then based on the answers to those questions and to the questionnaire and their interpretations of the rules, policies, and procedures of Dogger and the Water Board, we will develop a report that talks about the qualities of the program, both those things that we think the program is doing well and those things we think where the program can use some improvement. We cover four basic areas. The first of these is program framework. That's the administrative side. We'll look at staffing and funding, any jurisdictional issues related to who has control and that sort of thing. The second is permitting. We'll talk about the technical aspects of permitting, the administrative aspects of permitting, including things like bonding and other financial assurance. Then we'll go into areas like the area of review, because it's part of the technical aspect of permitting. We then talk about well construction, and not only just the construction, but we go into areas of mechanical integrity testing of wells. Beyond that, we talk about inspections. And when I say inspections, there's two different types. First of these is specific inspections for things like well construction. Is the agency send someone out to witness well construction during especially surface casing construction? Do they witness mechanical integrity tests? If so, what percentage of mechanical integrity tests do they witness? What are the procedures for doing these sorts of things? And then, of course, we talk about routine testing, which is where they would go out and they would do things like look at the well itself and look at gauges to determine what the pressures are and the volumes are and that sort of thing. And that's the inspection and compliance section of the review. Those are the four basic sections of the review. After the interview process is conducted, we will go back and the team will write its basic report. We will sit down as a team. We will edit the report. We will then send the report to Dogger and the Water Board for their comment. After they have commented on the report, we will take a look at their comments. We may have a follow-up discussion with them about the comments, and then we will finalize our report. Important thing to remember is that this report is a consensus-style report. We don't allow minority reports by the other team members, so if a team member has a disagreement, we work through the disagreements and determine how we can come up with a consensus answer
to the questions that we might have. Under normal circumstances, these reviews will result in a report in 60 to 90 days. Whether fortunately or unfortunately for California, they have a complex program, a larger program, and so we're expecting this report to take probably 90 to 120 days at a minimum, after which the report will be available. We hope you will feel free to use it in any aspect you wish. We hope it is simply to, for you folks, is simply to be informative. You can make your decisions, obviously, and you will and should, on your own review of the program, but we hope our report will inform your decision-making process. So at that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have. Yeah, Andrew.
Yeah, you mentioned the area of review component. Are you asking staff how area of your review is handled on new permits, or will you actually be going back and looking at historical implementation of the area of your review requirements? One of the documents that the panel read was the 2015 report that looked at just a sample of wells in Los Angeles, and it found that a very low percentage actually had conducted a full area of review. And so I'm curious how GWPC would try to answer that question, if you even do, in this process.
Okay. Yeah, we're going to look at it as part of the permitting process. In our, and I'll just say this up front, in our opinion, area review is something that has to be done on every injection well when you're doing a permit. And for the most part, depending upon circumstances, when agencies do follow-up reviews, which we typically call file reviews, which are generally done every 5 years, the area of review should be looked at again, because obviously the changes can occur within that area of review. New wells can be drilled, old wells can be plugged, and so on and so forth. So yes, area of review is part of what we will look at from a perspective of what the agency does and what we think they should do.
But what about what they have done?
Well, I mean, we're not going to get into, you guys didn't do this for so long, because that's not the point of the review. The point of the review is to determine what they're doing now and to make suggestions about how they can improve what they're doing now.
Got it.
Yes, Scott.
So what they're doing now obviously does include new permits. Would would you all also be looking, though, into what are they doing now about the backlog of past permits that were granted without adequate AOR?
Well, assuming that the agency is doing periodic file reviews, the answer is yes, because as I noted in a periodic file review, AOR should be part of that process. So if a well did not have an AOR review before, but it comes up for its file review, when that file review is conducted, the AOR should be reviewed at that time, yes.
So the review that we're doing, just to make sure I understand, is completely independent of your review?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Will this panel have an opportunity to comment or look at your review before it is completely finalized, or do you
we'll
want
be
to
providing the
separate?
Review to Dogger and the Water Board. Now, if Dogger and the Water Board are inclined to give it to you folks to take a look at it, that's certainly up to them. We're going to take our comments back from them, but if they want to give it to you to look at, then that's perfectly fine.
And the answer to that question is from Dogger and the Water Board?
I didn't even put Ken on the spot there. it's just not our call.
Has there been any discussion of that in Dogger or the Water Boards? Has there been any discussion of providing the draft GWPC review to this panel for its comment? And if there hasn't and you don't have an answer right now, that's fine too. But
just curious if that's come up or not.
Well, it's the first time anybody's asked the question. I don't think we have any issues with the with you all seeing it. Now, I will ask. Tit for tat. I'll put Mike Nicholas on the spot and say, Mike, if I give these guys the report and they look at it and they have comments, what are you going to do with the comments?
We'll do the same thing with your comments as we will do with Dogger's comments. We'll evaluate them based on our own experience as Class 2 UIC program directors and managers and determine whether or not they should be in the report. Just as your report is independent, our report is independent as well.
Yes, Dan.
I'm a little confused that this is the first time the question's come up, because in the pre-meeting materials I was provided with, there's a major heading that says what the panel will do, and bullet number one is observe, comment on, and review a peer review conducted by the Groundwater Protection Council, etc. And the second bullet is that we are to seek input on the findings of the peer review from a broad range of stakeholders and the public.
Well, I think the way that, so it's how you read that, and I will give you my interpretation, is that's after, my impression was that was after it was finalized. You would have it available to you to use in any way you saw fit. The idea of you looking at the draft and commenting on the draft, that's a new question. But if you all would like to do that, we will make it available to you. Something that you want to discuss later on and not answer today among yourselves when you can do
right,
that.
Right, and one thing I think that the panel may not know, that I've reviewed every report that they've done for California as well as some other states where I was interested, but they do put their follow-up questions and comments from the agency in those reports, too, in the final. So you see the whole progression when the final report is issued, which helps you evaluate, do you think that the agencies answered the questions properly that the audit had, and vice versa. So in my view, it doesn't make much difference whether we commented on it before or commented on the completion. To me, it's more interesting to see how the responses went and have the whole document put together than to comment on the draft document when you don't know what the agencies are going to respond or how they're going to respond. I find it very informative to have the whole thing. But we can talk about it and decide what we want to do.
And Justin, Preston, you will let us know on what the decision is, I assume.
Yes.
Okay.
Are there any other questions for Mike?
You're an easy group. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Mike. So with that, with this little bit of strange dynamic I've set up, if we can go to the slides that I prepared. Now we can finally get to know each other a little better and let the public know who we are. I get the feeling a lot of you know each other, but I don't know everybody, and I doubt anybody in here knows everybody who's in here. So I just thought we'd go around and do introductions, and these are listed in the order of the groups that are required to be represented on this panel by SB 83, which is the legislation that has caused this panel to form. So there's no nothing more in the order of this that's implied than that's how it appeared in the legislation. So maybe if we could start with Mike or Michael Bruno, I don't know which you prefer, so maybe you could also say your name as how you like to hear it said to you.
Okay, yeah, thanks. My name is Mike Bruno, and I'm with Geomechanics Technologies. You know, we are basically a research and consulting firm. We get involved in
design, permitting, monitoring, and analysis, including risk analysis of injection wells. And we work in the oil and gas area, in the gas storage field, and in CO2 sequestration projects. I would say probably 75% of our funding is contract research, a lot of that from the Department of Energy, and maybe 25% of our research and consulting funding is from the oil and gas industry.
Oh, thank you. Very interesting. And then moving on to Catherine or Kathy Rehise-Boyd, and I might be butchering your name. I apologize if I am.
You actually did really well.
Okay.
Yeah, I really appreciate being asked to serve on the panel. So I've been with the Western States Petroleum Association for 29 years and in the oil and gas industry for about 36 now. So I'm getting tired. But this is a really good process. I've also been very involved in the Interstate Oil and Gas Compact Commission as California's industry reps for many years, Groundwater Protection Council work. Been through several program reviews of the state oil and gas program over my tenure. So this is great to be looking at this specific one. Also very happy to see the national labs involved. It's been in the old days of old, we had the national labs really involved in a lot of our analysis, and it was really helpful to have that scientific lens on everything we do. So I'm really glad to see that back. And then just also when I was getting prepared for this discussion today, just looking over the comprehensive nature on this topic is amazing. So I've been involved in fact, several of us are on this AB 617 stakeholder group on the community monitoring program that's going on simultaneously to this stakeholder group. But it's just amazing how much information has been collected on this topic over the years. So, whether it's the regs themselves, the checklist that goes with them, the renewal plan, the MOA, the UIC program, project by project, the interagency work group that's going on also on all of this material in SB 855, which is the report to the legislature by Dogger. I mean, just going through all the material, just we are blessed as a stakeholder group to have so much good information going into this process. And then I just say going forward, just really interested to make sure that all of us participate in making sure this program can be as effective and efficient as possible, but also with that scientific technical lens on it so that we are flexible enough to realize not one size fits all, that there are uniquenesses to which we develop this program around. So just thank all of my stakeholder members here to go through this process together. So thank you.
Thanks so much. Thanks for welcoming me, and I guess I'll include Randy in that since he's with the National Labs as well. Certainly a pleasure to be here. I'm Dan Torme.
There we go. Thank you, Preston. My name's Dan Torme. I'm president of Catalyst Environmental Solutions. It's an environmental consulting firm focusing on energy, water quality, and land management issues. Personally, I've worked on UIC issues for 15 years with more of a focus on the water quality side of things as opposed to mechanical integrity testing and things like that. I've been on the CCST SB4 steering committee looking at the effects of well stimulation in California. There's several alumni here at the table from that as well. I was on an assembly panel looking at offshore hydraulic fracturing and a National Academy of Science science advisory board for Giant Sequoia National Monument. Educationally, I have a bachelor's from Stanford, civil engineering and geology, and a doctorate from MIT in geology and geochemistry. And I'm really excited to be working with you guys.
And I note that it's Tormi. I believe I mispronounced it first time out. So.
It's an acceptable variant.
Okay, well, thank you. Yeah. And next is Mary Jane Wilson.
Well, I'm very pleased to be here working with the whole group, many of whom I've already met and worked with before. I'm president of WZI, and we do a lot of oil and gas and geology field development and aquifer exemptions, and just lately, since 2013 and 14, when the issues came up. But I was also involved in the UIC program when it was first initiated and came out in the Federal Register. Many of the documents that have been gone through leading up to the issues with the aquifer exemptions came out of some of the files that I had, or copies of discussions that I had when the program was first being developed. That makes me very old. But consequently, it was a program that when it first came out, I knew that it would change the oil and gas industry forever on how we did it, even though I was very proud of how California was regulating its underground injection control. This issue needed assistance by the Safe Drinking Water Act. And I think it's important that we do our best as the independent review panel to make good recommendations that are solid, that will carry the program forward for many years.
Well, as somebody who's slightly younger, perhaps, I want to thank you for being an archivist for our state. And if I'm understanding what you're saying, actually having some of those documents that
They said I was a pack rat.
I would never put it that way. So moving on to public health, and if anybody doesn't agree with which bin I put them in, please also speak up and protest. This is my understanding, but that could be incorrect. So Randy, Madalena.
Thank you, Preston, and thank you for allowing me to be on this panel. This looks like it's going to be an exciting project. I am with Lawrence Berkeley National Lab in Energy Analysis and Environmental Impacts Division. Mostly I'm a chemist. I go by being an analytical chemist, but it's driven by the public health aspect, so I generally measure things in the environment. My research is somewhat driven by measuring things that we get exposed to in terms of risk assessment, so health hazards and the like. So I was part of the SB4 project, working with Preston on that, mostly in the hazard chapter, and that was quite an experience. The learning curve was quite steep going into a new industry, and it was fun, and I'm excited to see if I can remember some of that as I work through this program. Thank you.
And next is Seth Shonkoff.
Hello, everyone. I'm Seth Shonkoff. I wear a few hats. I am the executive director of a energy science and policy research institute called PSE. I also have formal research affiliations at UC Berkeley and Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. A lot of my research focuses on public health, air and water dimensions of oil and gas and energy production in general. In terms of my background in this space, I also was on the SB4 study. With Randy, we and a number of others, we worked up the public health assessment chapter, as well as a LA basin case study on public health. I've also been involved in another CCST study focused on natural gas storage, obviously spurred by the Aliso Canyon incident, but much larger than that. Preston also worked closely with us on that, which was great. And again, I was one of the leads on the public health assessment of that. And pertinent specifically to this issue, I'm also on a food safety expert panel convened by the Central Valley Water Board to look at issues of produced water reuse. I'm one of the public health voices on that panel. And it's great to be a part of this. I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you. And Scott Anderson, I think when reading your bio, you're maybe one of the people that I was, wow, you have a lot of different dimensions to your experience. So I think you're in the right bin, but tell me if you're not.
Yeah, I have lots of bins, right? Yeah. So Scott Anderson, I'm from Austin,
Texas, and with Environmental Defense Fund, I lead a team that works on land and water issues relating to upstream oil and gas. Well integrity is one of our prime focuses, and we also work on surface spills and leaks and produced water management more generally. So I've been doing that for 6 years. So for 5 years before that, or 8 years, and for 5 years before that, I concentrated on geologic sequestration of carbon dioxide. And for 25 years before that, I was with the Texas Independent Producers and Royalty Owners Association, was the general counsel and the executive director. I've been a member of IOGCC since 86 and was probably one of two surviving members at the founding meeting of the Underground Injection Practices Control Council, which later became GWPC, in 1982.
Thank you very much. And moving on to Laura Feinstein.
I am Laura Feinstein. I'm presently with Pacific Institute. We're a think tank that focuses on issues of water sustainability. We do a lot of work internationally and then a lot of work also focused in California. I got my start actually in oil and gas issues when I was a science and technology fellow with the state legislature. And I got handed a bunch of bills, one of which was called SB 4 to analyze. Little did I know, 6 years later, I'd still be kind of dealing with that professional aftermath. Worked on some legislation pertaining to oil and gas in that year, and then I was with California Council on Science and Technology during both the Bureau of Land Management and the Natural Resources Agency SB4 studies. I led the work on impacts to ecosystems, the Monterey Source Rock case study, and then I believe I was ex officio on the steering committee. Did a lot of work close with the steering committee, crafting the summary report and the executive report. And then since then, haven't been as focused on oil and gas issues, but I am involved in one study that's looking at the impacts of the recycled water for irrigation in the Central Valley. So do continue to have interest in the issues of produced water.
Thank you. Moving on to Andrew Grinberg.
Hi there. My name is Andrew Grinberg. I'm with Clean Water Action. We're a national environmental nonprofit active in about 15 different states, including here in California. I worked out of our Bay Area office for a number of years and got to work on a lot of the legislation that has been discussed today, including SB 4, SB 1281, and various regulatory issues at Dogger and the Water Board, including UIC and disposal into produced water pits. I'm now based in Washington, D.C., and so I get to continue working on some California issues, but also issues in other states. And so I appreciated the comments by Mary Jane earlier about how this is a bigger than just a California issue, and we've begun to identify some of these parallel issues going on in places like Texas and Oklahoma and the implementation of the UIC and aquifer exemption programs. And so I really do think that the work that we do here on this panel to help, you know, make California a leader once again on this issue and get caught up to speed and make sure we're protecting our groundwater like we should be, could be a model for other places. And we look to, you know, make sure that we do the best job possible here so that other states can follow suit. And, you know, they may need a little more work to admit that they've got a problem like we did here. But I think we can get there and keep exposing this and showing the way. So thank you.
Thank you, Andrew. And Brianna Mordick.
Hi, I'm Brianna Mordick. I'm a senior scientist with the Natural Resources Defense Council. I work kind of broadly on finding solutions to reduce the environmental impacts of oil and gas production and just generally ensuring that policy is informed by the best available science, including working on UIC at the federal level, state level, including disposal, enhanced oil recovery, and carbon sequestration. I'm a petroleum geologist by background. I came to NRDC from the oil and gas industry, where I also worked on UIC from the producer's perspective, including both disposal and CO2, enhanced oil recovery. So appreciate the panel, or appreciate the opportunity to work on the panel, and look forward to working with all of you guys.
And that was just the first page. This is quite a panel, so how we run the process is going to be something we'll have to talk about, but we won't do that so much today, maybe on our first phone call. I'm going to Environmental Justice, Gustavo Aguirre, if you could help me out.
Yeah, so hello, everyone. My name is Gustavo Aguirre, Jr. I'm the project coordinator for Kern County with Central California Environmental Justice Network. I've been with CCEJN for 4 years now, where my primary role is leading an environmental justice task force of local, regional, and state regulators to work and address issues in the community. Issues revolving around pesticide, industrial, agricultural, dairies, oil and gas industry, et cetera. I was raised in the farm worker justice movement. My grandfather and father were both farm workers, worked alongside Cesar Chavez, so all I know is activism. And transitioned from activism to more development role within the organization. I'm also with Mrs. Boyd in the ARB AB617 consultation state group. So I'm excited to be here, really honored to be here, and I'm really hoping to integrate the perspective of environmental justice working with, you know, grassroots organizations or along the Central Valley. I know some of the folks here have done some amazing work, so I really look forward for this.
Thank you. And Juan Flores.
Good evening. No, good afternoon, everyone. It's barely 3 o'clock. It is a real pleasure to be on this panel with all of you. I'm a community organizer. I've been a community organizer for the last 8-9 years of my life with the Center on Race, Poverty, and Environment, where we work with community facing issues with air quality, water quality, land use. And I'm really excited of being part of this panel, given the different backgrounds that we all have, to finally perhaps close some of those misconceptions that have been created during the years, right, from both sides. But at the same time, to be able to represent those communities that are the real faces of perhaps all the numbers and studies that we all going to be working on or have been working through our lives. You know, those people that are really affected and impacted every day of their lives. So it's a real pleasure being here.
Thank you. And moving on to the agriculture stakeholders, Larry Farini is not here. I don't know if he's on the phone or not, but the phone is one way, if my understanding is correct, meaning out, not in. Oh, it is both ways. Okay. Mr. Farini, are you on the phone? Hearing none, we'll move on to Patricia Poré. Okay.
Thank you also for this opportunity to participate on this panel. It's pretty amazing just to listen to the colleagues here, so I look forward to this opportunity. A little bit about me. 10 years I've worked for Grimway Farms, largest carrot producer in the world, located their corporate office in Kern County. I just recently left the company to take a position under the new Groundwater Sustainability Act. I'm the new planning manager for the Kern Groundwater Authority, the GSA for the County of Kern. So I've worked with all of the water districts in order to comply with the new SGMA requirements. My history prior to, well, with Grimway Farms is I worked really well with the oil industry as the Kern County went to the first EIR. I am second vice president of the Kern County Farm Bureau. I'm the first woman to hold that position. So it has been exciting to work with oil. When we went through the EIR, it works well in Kern County. Oil and ag have always worked well in Kern County. So I bring a different perspective, I think, from some of the rumors that are out there. And so I look forward to this opportunity. And thank you.
SGMA, that's an exciting mission you have ahead of you.
Reason for the question is about the water monitoring.
Yeah.
One of the undesirable results is water quality.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Moving to scientific and academic research, Professor Jan Gillespie.
Hi, I'm Jan Gillespie. This is going to be an interesting panel to work on. I'm a geologist, a registered geologist in California, and I started out in life as a geologist, at least as a geological engineer in the oil and gas industry in the Pacific Coast Division out of Bakersfield. Did a little work also in the Gulf Coast and the Williston Basin, and also in the basins of Wyoming. Left Bakersfield to go on for a PhD and just to prove that the Hotel California is right. You can check out anytime you like, but you can never leave. I graduated and ended up back at Cal State Bakersfield as a professor. And so there I taught subsurface mapping, oil and gas geology, and a little bit of groundwater geology. Since then, I've undertaken a lot of different projects. I've been working in carbon capture and storage with Preston out at Berkeley Labs. I've also been a member of the advisory panel for SB4, which is run out of Lawrence Berkeley Labs. And lately, I've been working with first with Dogger and then with the U.S. Geological Survey to map the base of protected aquifers, mainly in Kern County, so we know exactly what aquifers need to be protected and which ones presumably don't. So that's been really fun, and I'm continuing to work with the U.S. Geological Survey on that, looking at the aquifer architecture and trying to figure out what the salinity trends are within those aquifers.
Great, thank you. And I believe Professor Rob Jackson is on the phone.
I am. I don't know if you can hear me, but I hope so.
We can hear you.
First of all, my apologies for not being there. I was out of the country until late last night, and unfortunately, this time of the year, we're still in session. Our classes end next week, and I couldn't miss another Tuesday, Thursday afternoon class. But I chair the Earth System Science Department here at Stanford, and like many people on the panel have a long-term interest in groundwater and interactions with energy. My group and colleagues did some of the first work on drinking water and hydraulic fracturing, kind of highlighting the importance of well integrity. We've done work on wastewater disposal and chemistry and such. And I have also a long-term interest in relatively deep groundwater, sort of where it is, how much of it there is, and how and where and whether it intersects with different activities such as oil and gas extraction. So I come to the panel primarily through the lens of environmental and earth sciences.
Thank you, Rob. And I guess finally, just by accident, I'm on the slide last. So I've worked at Lawrence Berkeley Lab since 1990. For the first few years I was hired there, I worked on paleoseismicity, which is prehistoric earthquake identification, and then moved into groundwater cleanup of the lab itself. The lab was started in 1939, and so like any industrial facility, there was various types of contamination that I worked on cleaning up. In the middle of last decade, I switched to research, primarily on geologic carbon storage, specifically focusing on risk assessments. But over the last few years, I've had the pleasure of being involved in various scientific endeavors with the state. Those have been mentioned by a number of panelists, and I've been privileged to benefit from the knowledge of many of the panelists who are here today in that past work, and I'm looking forward to learning more from you and from the ones I haven't met before. So I think with that, I'll leave it. So just to say a few words about the panel and the report process. So there will be four public meetings that are tentatively scheduled. This is the first one, so this is the kickoff. We've tentatively scheduled one in Bakersfield in October. The date hasn't been finalized yet. And that is, again, to gather public input. What this body has done by that time and what this body presents is entirely up to discussion among us. The second public meeting after this one, what I'm calling mid-course two, will be in Long Beach and very tentatively in April. It is to follow the release of the Groundwater Protection Council report. And at that meeting, that report and those findings and recommendations would be presented, is my understanding and hope. And we would also be gathering input for our work at that meeting. And then the final meeting
will be in Sacramento back here in June of 2019 to present this panel's findings or recommendations. Now, whether, again, that's June, you know, it's somewhat dependent on what the panel wants to discuss, what it wants to get into, and when the Groundwater Protection Council's work is done. But that's the skeleton of the plan at the moment. Now, those wouldn't obviously be our only meetings. We will also have meetings of just the panel. And unless somebody has a burning desire to all get back together again in person, which is certainly fun, we would do those as virtual meetings, call-in meetings with, you know, visuals. I'm sure you've all done that before. So that would be the approach. And we'll be reviewing, as you've already heard, the Groundwater Protection Council report. We have the opportunity to request data of the agencies. So if there's something that the panel agrees is information that we'd like to have from the agencies, we can make that request. We can also obviously ask questions to the agencies. As far as the report process, ideally, we'll come to consensus around our findings and recommendations. That's certainly the goal. I would say there is the opportunity for minority report, unlike the Groundwater Protection Council process. Fortunately, in the previous processes I've been through that are similar to this, the SB4 report, the work before that for the Bureau of Land Management, the steering committee was able to come to consensus, so I think we've got a good track record in that regard, and hopefully we can get there. Whatever report we put together will be peer-reviewed, and then we'll have report monitors check if we have addressed the comments of the peer reviewers adequately. So it's a multi-stage process, which I've never run into before myself, before I think 4 years ago. So if you're not familiar with this, you will be by the end. Just to reiterate, this is what's in SB 83. This is the charge to the panel. To evaluate the regulatory performance of the Division of Oil, Gas, and Geothermal Resources Administration of the Underground Injection Control Program, and to make recommendations on how to improve the effectiveness of the program, including resource needs and statutory or regulatory changes, as well as program reorganization, including transferring the program to the State Water Resources Control Board. So I've highlighted to evaluate the Underground Injection Control Program. There's certainly many fascinating aspects of oil and gas and oil regulation of that industry and the science of that industry. And this panel's charge, while I certainly look forward to talking about all those aspects with you as sidebars, this panel's charge is really focused on the Underground Injection Control Program. So I just want to put that out there for clarity for us and for the public and for the agencies that we understand that. And I think with that, maybe we'll open up to public comment. I don't see a tremendous amount of public here. Maybe a show of hands, how many people would like to actually talk? Nobody wants to talk. Okay.
I have a question, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Will the panel be looking at the portions of the Dogger and water programs that are under the Class 5 program, the geothermal injection? Because our report will not. We will be looking strictly at Class 2.
That is a great question. I don't have an answer. Yeah, okay. I hadn't thought about that. Thank you for raising that.
I think ours is Class 2.
Okay. Okay, well, I know there was some...
Because Dogger does
some,
do...
Well, yeah, there's some of the Class 5 program, which is...
So like the water injection wells and the geysers, for instance.
That would be, yeah, the geothermal wells.
And those fall under Class 5.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Interesting. Okay. All right. Well, something for us to talk about.
I just wanted you to know that we will only be doing Class 2.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for raising that.
I just wanted to clarify. Ben, did you say that you guys don't have primacy for Class 5? Is that right? Or...
You need to, can you, yeah, thanks.
State of California does not have primacy for Class 5. The permitting scheme is a lot looser for Class 5 under US EPA, and Dogger does. It's the GER and Dogger, is geothermal resources. It is a separate program. It's not regulated under the Class 2 program, the UIC program that's been outlined today, You would have to come up to speed on how that program is regulated. So it's different technical aspects, different regulations, different statutes.
I'm Ben Turner with the Department of Conservation. When the legislation SB 83 was passed, it was with respect to legislative oversight on the underground injection control program, with generally oriented towards Class 2 because it was about DARTA receiving more positions and whether or not the Water Board should have oversight of the Class 2 program rather than DARTA having oversight of the Class 2 program. So the legislature, when they enacted this oversight idea, it was about oil and gas injection and disposal.
Did they have a staff report that discussed that we could see?
There was an oversight hearing in March of 2015, but this was passed. Senate Bill 83 was passed in a budget trailer bill, so the analysis of that bill was fairly sparse. It was just kind of the bill. It just described what the bill did. It didn't say what the background was or anything. But I can send you links to the oversight hearings and the budget hearings where members of the legislature, including at that time Senator Pavley and Senator Wolk, discussed their concerns about the division and their oversight of the Class 2 program.
I think that would be helpful if you could do that. Thank you.
I'll do that.
So just for clarity, does DARTA have the authority to permit a Class 5 water injection well associated with the geothermal project? Or does EPA issue those permits?
There's a state statute providing for permitting of geothermal wells and geothermal projects, which is allowed under the Class 5. So there's some overlap with Class 5 injection.
Okay. Thank you. So just for clarity, so if a geothermal project includes an injection well, DARTA can permit that without the involvement of U.S. EPA?
No. No.
Okay.
That's incorrect.
Okay, that's what I'm trying to figure out.
To get another permit.
You have to, okay.
EPA.
Commonly with Class 5, you might have to get a state permit and a permit from.
Okay, that's what I was trying to get at. Thank you for clarifying that. All right, well, with no... Yeah. You had a question, Laura?
I heard your projected timeline of how long it's going to take to prepare the Groundwater Protection Council review, but I didn't hear projected dates when you think the draft might go to the agencies for review and then a projected approximate date. I know this is probably a lot of... I hate it when people ask me these questions, but I'll go ahead and ask you when you think the final will be out.
Well, all right, let's do a little calculation in our heads right away. We're going to be coming back to do the in-state interview portion from the 18th to the 22nd, actually the 19th to the 21st of this month. Assuming we can get a draft report.
You mean June?
We're still in May. Oh, that's right. Excuse me. Yeah, I'm a little behind myself. Yeah, of June. Assuming that we can get the report to Dogger within 120 days, then it depends on when we get it back from Dogger and the Water Board as to when the final report will be out. I would assume that once we have it back, it will take 30 to 60 days to do a final. So the only gap in there is how long it takes the agencies to review and provide comments to the report.
So... And one more schedule question. You had said you were expecting the questionnaires that you had given to Dogger. You were expecting those back soon, I think it was, something like that.
I'm hoping yet this week, this afternoon, if I can get them, because I have to get them to the team. I'm working with Brady and the folks at the Water Board on that. Yes.
Yeah, so my thought is just going through the math there, it sounds like the final is going to be, you know, late spring of 2019. And since we have our final is supposed to be June of 2019, and one of our tasks is to review that report, we may actually want to see a draft rather than wait for the final, because we're not going to get the final until well into next year?
Well, under the 120 plus, 60 plus, whatever the agency does,
right,
that'd be approximately 7 months. So we could potentially see the final in January, February. That would be maybe the earliest. I'm not in any way discounting that we should see the draft so we can get a head start on it. But I think the final should come before, likely before spring. Yes, Dan.
Just to put it out there, we've heard from our introductions that a lot of us are science-based, and science-based people tend to like data. It might be nice to get those questionnaires, too, just to put it out there.
Yeah, and I think the agencies had already thought about that, and we're going to pass those on, was my understanding. I see Brady nodding yes, so I think that's already been discussed. So from here, we could do a number of things. One idea I had was to, again, since there's so many of us, it's hard to really have conversations back and forth amongst us. But what might be useful starting place is to just kind of go around and have people express if there's aspects of the UIC program that they are in particular suggesting that this panel look at. We can start to build up a list from which you can work, prioritize, agree, disagree. But I think that type of brainstorming might be a way to get us going. If people have other suggestions, I'm open to that. But that's my thought for how to use the remainder of this time. So I think not seeing any protest otherwise, I think I'll start over here, if you're willing, and if you're not, then we'll start over with the empty chair over there. I don't know what happened there, but yeah.
No, I'll go ahead and start. Based on the presentations today, and looking at it from an agricultural perspective, what I would hope to find out is, and as SGMA begins to unfold, is the water quality monitoring perspective on, I know under SB4 it required monitoring requirements originally, so it would be interesting to see how we can connect the dots so that we are looking at it as efficiently, especially in Kern County, since there's already a lot of straws in the aquifers. So it'd be nice to be able to do it efficiently under maybe coordinating the monitoring with SGMA requirements so that we're not looking at more straws that we don't need. Also to under irrigated lands, which has also got a requirement for monitoring, and CV salts. So it would be nice to be able to come up with some kind of strategy on how best to monitor for programs that overlay each other with the assistance of the water board, looking at it from that perspective, since mostly those programs fall under the water board's privy. The other part, too, is also to make sure that as we move forward, that we talk about, you know, the science of it, and we talk about the underneath the ground, there is still that surface owner on the top. And so I just want to make sure that we don't lose sight of that surface owner who ultimately has responsibilities of making sure that they're able to use their surface as they originally purchased it for. And I know going through the oil EIR at the County of Kern, we came up with a policy that the surface owner and the oil company work collaboratively to work through those issues. So,
great. Thanks. Thank you. Yeah, certainly that's, I know it's a taxpayer, which is necessarily my role here, having multiple programs that aren't coordinated. Doesn't always appeal to my bottom line. And just by the way, if it looks like I'm texting, I'm actually taking notes. You may not believe me, but that's what I'm doing. I'm not texting with people out there in the world. I just find this is better than paper for me because then I always have it with me. Mike Bruno.
Okay, well, I guess I'm going to just see how this plays out over the next few months. You know, my personal thought is that the key issue that, or one of the issues that the panel should look at is, and comment on is, you know, what sort of monitoring is being proposed, new monitoring, what sort of reporting, and what sort of actions. You know, of course, there's a new emphasis on doing appropriate area of reviews, and many of us know very well what, you know, how to do some of those, and doing simulations and so forth. But ultimately, you really have to rely on monitoring and feeding back into, you know, what your models are saying. And, you know, what is the appropriate level of pressure, temperature monitoring in the subsurface? What should be reported? You know, obviously a average injection pressure over a month is not sufficient, but perhaps, you know, continuous pressure monitoring and temperature monitoring is overkill. And then finally, what actions are taken when monitoring indicates that pressures have gone above maximum allowable surface pressure and so forth. So really that's the would be my interest and focus is what is the monitoring, reporting, and actions that are being contemplated in going forward.
Great. Thank you. Jan.
Well, obviously I've been working a lot with what aquifers need to be protected, so that's where I feel like my role on this committee is going to be. The other thing I'm kind of interested in, although I don't have a lot of expertise in it, is wellbore integrity issues. How are they monitored for? I know a lot of times wells aren't completely, of course, cemented all the way to the surface. They're cemented around the producing zone. They're cemented around the surface casings. How do we monitor for things like that? As Michael just said, how do we monitor for changes in pressure over time? I know that just a little short period of time of injection above the maximum allowable pressure, even though it might not show up in the monthly reports, can certainly lead to formation issues, fracking issues, for instance, where you can cross-contaminate aquifers. So those would be some things I'd be interested in.
Great. Thank you. Juan.
Yeah, I would like to, I'm interested in see those aquifers that can be protected for future use, whether it's domestic or agricultural use, especially in the Central Valley, in Kern County specifically, right, where a lot of our economy depends on that as well. And like Mr. Bruno, on the monitoring, reporting, and the enforcement to see what is being recommended, and pretty much to see how that's going to play on the ground. I would like to see that.
Great. Thank you. Is it Kathy or Catherine? I don't remember which.
Kathy's fine.
Kathy, okay. Thanks, Kathy.
My staff calls me Kath, so that's fine too.
Okay. Well, I won't do that. I'll keep it at Kathy.
Okay.
Okay.
So the first and foremost, I think this the theme of transparency and consistency remain real high on our list. And I would imagine since the regs are cornerstone and we're all waiting for them, that's going to be a pretty critical piece of our business. And as I said earlier, you know, just want to ask ourselves in what cases, I mean, it's not necessarily one size fits all in all cases, and can you make some distinguishes between categories of injection wells that have, say, different geological surface, you know, subsurfaces. There's all those, you know, specifics around that. And then just relative to the discussion of cost, obviously cost is important, and obviously we'll spend whatever we need to for the protection side of the equation, but is the cost also commensurate with the technical justification? So I think that balance between the two is also going to be something we look forward to. And then would love to hear more about SGMA because I'm not that familiar with it, but I think your comments were really spot on. How can we make sure we're consistent or find synergies, I guess, between these programs as we go forward?
Thank you. Mary Jane.
Well, I have to agree with Kathy that transparency is very important, and I think having the regulations be able to treat all different kinds of situation, and that is difficult to do because, like I said before, each reservoir is unique, and so we need to make sure that we actually understand when we put a regulation down what it is going to do in at least a wide variety of situations. And so I'm looking to review with this group the regulations as they come out with the underground. I'm sorry, I keep calling you your old name, your Protection Council, and your report to see how you're integrating both the Water Board's regulations and DOGGR regulations, because just like on the Class 5, where they're two separate sets of permits, I think in this case we should have the regulations so that when a permit is issued, even though it's reviewed by multiple agencies, that everyone knows what it means. And I think that's really important because other people can't review it. Juan couldn't review it if he didn't know. So clarity and transparency is really important.
Thank you. Dan.
Well, this is one time where I kind of come to this as almost a blank slate to kind of see where we're going and, you know, go from there. But there were two major areas of interest that were starting to coalesce in my mind as we were having our discussion today. And one of them surrounds the permit process, which I know is going to be a major part, Mike, of your review. But, you know, not to focus too much on the past, but the process that began in part with the CCST recommendation to take a closer look at how regulation into or potentially affecting protected aquifers was being conducted in the state, that in part led to a regulatory process that from the producer's point of view was very onerous, not well-defined, drifting. The amount and type of data required a lot of uncertainty surrounding that. And so in looking forward, kind of learning from that experience, things that with the process going forward bring more clarity to things like timing. Mary Jane, you brought up the relative role of the state board versus the regional board. You know, where do those two entities fall within the permit process? So there's a host of things there that just in preparing and through our talks today fall under that rubric of making sure the permit process learns from the recent past and brings that forward to have protective, transparent, but also more predictable process. Mm-hmm. The second major issue, I'm not really sure to the extent we're really going to be able to get into this, but you know, as a Californian, you know, water is precious here, and produced water is this major source of new water. And, you know, again, I'm not sure the degree to which this is going to come into our proceedings, but that balance between what you inject for disposal and what you may be able to beneficially reuse, I think, you know, if there's a place where we can address that kind of balance, I'd like to see us do that, you know, to recognize this as a potential resource if it can be used in a way that benefits like the ag community or others in the area who are really limited, obviously, by availability of water. And produced water is a pretty predictable source when you start looking at them. So, you know, I'd asked the question about the various sources of drinking water standards of 3,000 versus 10,000. That kind of plays into this of, you know, what's usable. Another aspect that plays into this is kind of artificially designating something a waste. You know, we talk about wastewater a lot, and even today we talk about it a lot. But if we just call it water and then look at it as it has to be fit for purpose, whatever that purpose is, and that appropriate testing or whatever assurances are needed to make sure it's fit for purpose that that's put in. So from the UIC perspective, and this, let's not lose sight that this is a big source of new water, not having a regulatory definition sneak in that adds an extra hurdle that isn't necessary.
Thank you. Laura.
My thoughts of kind of the priorities for the panel. One of the big things I was wondering about as I was going through the reading before we came here today was how much good work has already been done. For example, there were a lot of really thorough and strong recommendations made in the 2011 EPA audit and the 2015 Dogger review. And I think one of our priorities should be to not to start anew, but to go back and review those and try to see how progress is being made on the recommendations that already were made in past reports. And I was really glad to see this renewal plan progress report because it looks like some of that work is already ongoing. But I think that it's always helpful to have that independent perspective, which is what we bring to it. So I'd say go back and look at the old reports. What did they recommend, and how is work being carried out from those recommendations? The big question that was in the statute was, should the UIC program be transferred to the State Water Board? And I think we shouldn't forget about that. You know, as we went around, it seemed like most of us or many of us come from a scientific perspective, and it's important not to forget that that's a kind of a regulatory question. And I'm not sure if we're exactly the panel of experts to answer it, but we probably can find the right people to talk to. You know, I assume that a big reason why that question was asked is because the Division of Drinking Water a few years ago was transferred from the Department of Public Health to the State Water Board, and I assume that was probably what was on the mind of the legislature when they wrote that into the statute. As somebody who does work a large amount with the water board and issues around drinking water, I think many people or most people who kind of work in the area of public drinking water think that that was a good move, that the State Water Board has been more active in terms of actually enforcing existing regulations than the Department of Public Health was. So it raises this question, would the UIC program be better at the water board or at Dogger, but I don't think that necessarily, I think we should think about sort of the underlying reasons why it seemed like the Division of Drinking Water is managed better at the Water Board, and can we emulate some of the changes that were made without necessarily having to do a transfer? I don't think necessarily we want to look at, you know, we don't necessarily want to shrink Dogger's capacity to start thinking at a more technical and deeper level about issues of groundwater protection because they bleed into all their programs. It's important for Dogger to have scientists on staff and to be engaging in all these technical questions. You know, to some degree, just transferring it to the water board, I think it has pros and cons, and we should be careful when thinking about that question. And I think it would be really helpful to talk to a lot of the people who are big advocates and on the transfer of Division of Drinking Water. And then I like the suggestion of thinking about where we can find synergies between the type of groundwater monitoring that's being developed for SGMA and the type of groundwater monitoring that would be really useful for better understanding the impacts to water quality from UIC. I'm not sure, I wonder if the elevations are going to end up being so different of the aquifers we're interested in that it might not overlap, but I think it's worth looking at. There's no need to have two separate programs doing the same thing. And I think another big question I have as I'm looking at how the panel is formed is it seems like the information we're getting in is going to be from existing reports and then from the Groundwater Protection Council's interview questions, which seem like really great sources of information. But I do wonder if we should be thinking constructively about doing any kind of independent information gathering. I know we don't really have the resources to start doing our own research projects. But the big flag that comes up for me is that the questions that the Groundwater Protection Council is asking are so useful, but it's a questionnaire and they're asking the staff to respond should we be doing any kind of independent verification that intended processes are carried out as they are supposed to be, right? Because that has been one of the big issues in the past. And then last, I would just say that there's always these major questions about the Orphan and Abandoned Wells Program, and I know that's always been an issue for Dogger, of not getting enough funding, I believe, to really really be able to manage that Orphan and Abandoned Wells Program as robustly as they would like to, and that has a big interaction with UIC and the Zone of Endangering Influence question. So we should not forget about that program. I guess that's my summary. What was that, 6 points? I'll call myself done.
Okay, thanks. Brianna.
Thanks. I think the aspects that I'm most interested in, I mean, I do think it's important that we look at the program holistically, but particularly in understanding the past performance of the program and where there have been issues, really diving into whether the existing and proposed regulatory structure addresses the root causes of issues that have happened in the past. I'm similarly looking at the injection process. What are the sort of highest threat activities that happen throughout the injection process? And again, does the current and proposed regulatory structure adequately address those based on what we know about current science, current technology, current best practices? Because as we've heard, you know, many of these regulations are outdated, although they're in the process of being updated. And then I think, you know, given the issues that have already surfaced with California's program, particularly around the aquifer exemption program, really taking a fresh look at that program. Again, those are regulations that were written decades ago, when water treatment technology was different, when water needs were very different, and what can we bring to that discussion in particular about what the future of that aquifer exemption program could look like.
Thanks so much. Gustavo.
Yeah, thank you. So I'm really going to echo a lot of what has already been shared, with a lot of the mention of water quality, water monitoring. You know, in Kern County, we've had the residents we organize and work with are a lot of times from rural, unincorporated communities. And with industrial historic practices, agricultural, oil and gas, chemical manufacturing, there is no secret that the Central Valley water is poisonous. You know, a recent report just came out. TCP, you know, kind of a pesticide residue has leached into the systems, right? So I think the prioritization and the aspects that I really see coming from this panel would be to incorporate that human capital, right? There's a lot of capitals that are in interest, and mine is human capital, protecting residents from already poisonous air, water, etc. So I think, you know, creating safeguards long-term that will protect residents from potential leaching or contamination from this underground injection, it would be key for me.
Thank you, Andrew.
All right, got a few here. So the first one, I think, you know, one of the issues from the public perspective around many aspects of the oil and gas industry is, and it's come up a bunch, is transparency, but I think there's a kind of a deeper data gap question. And so in many aspects of this, whether it's chemical additives or, you know, it's come up injection pressure, I think we should start by taking just a survey of what the gaps in data are to be able to answer this question of, are we protecting underground sources of drinking water? On the regulatory front, you know, we've got kind of these moving processes happening concurrent to this process, and I think we need to kind of figure out how do we interact with that. And so with the proposed regulations for the UIC program, what, if any, is our role in that, and how is the timing actually going to work to be able to comment on it or see the next draft, and just getting clear on what the expectation or the plan is there. And there's a little more certainty, I guess, with the timing of the new MOU with the Water Board and Dogger, since we've seen a draft, but do we want to consider something on that front as well? And do we want to weigh in on that somehow? I'll echo Brianna's comment on aquifer exemptions, and just to kind of get a little more specific, you know, many groups in the environmental space have a question of whether or not the criteria for aquifer exemptions are appropriate based on the technologies that are available today and will be available in the future, and, you know, the realities of climate change and water supply and population growth and changes. So I think it's worth, you know, and it just fits in with which waters should be protected, and that's been a question raised, but really specifically, what is the criteria for deciding to exempt an aquifer from Safe Drinking Water Act protection, and what is the state's role in maybe going beyond that?
Thank you. Randy.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to circle all the way back to the first comment on monitoring and reporting, the first couple of comments, because I think that's an important place that I'm interested in, and it links back to the updating modernization of the data management plan specifically. And so I think I kind of think we need to I personally need to drill down into this a little better and understand essentially what I would just call the data quality, because data management is important, but having data initial data entry being essentially by an operator or a producer or by a regulator, all the different perspectives of what that data means and how many significant figures you would even put down. So if you actually modernize the data management system, and the data that's input into that system is of low quality or hasn't been verified or validated in some fashion, then it becomes a little bit harder or sometimes not even useful in the future when the scientists or the regulators want to look at that and try and see if something has happened or if there's a trend. So that's where I would tend to focus is on the data quality that goes into what we are measuring, whether it's temperature, pressure, or a specific chemical concentration. Those are all very different factors that go into the decision making, but the level of quality is still, you know, critical.
Thank you, Seth.
So I'm the last one. So
there's somebody on the phone.
Right.
Don't forget Rob.
Sorry, Rob. But I'm the last one, at least after hearing a lot of really excellent comments come down this long line of people. So, you know, I'm also going to be echoing a lot and repeating a few things. I think at the core of what I think we're being asked to do, it's to look at the performance of Dogger's handling of this program and to make some judgment calls on how it was handled. Things, you know, throughout the program, including aquifer exemptions, permitting, et cetera. So, you know, when push comes to shove, I think, you know, I'm a scientist. I would love to look at everything. But I think that, you know, a little bit of, I get a little bit concerned that, you know, we're going to ask for too much and not whittle it down to the stuff that we really need. So just as like a word of caution around mission creep, I think we need to be careful. That said, there are a few items that I think are going to be critical for us to evaluate performance. One is to really, and this has been said by a few people, to really get into the details and the nitty-gritty of criteria used for exemptions. What are they? How are they operationalized? Have the criteria been stuck to? Are the criteria appropriate? Should there be different criteria? I think we really need to get into that. To echo Laura's point, you know, the Groundwater Protection Council's report, I think, is going to be very valuable, and I'm thrilled that it's going to be rolled out in the state. And it's survey questions, which at the end of the day probably should be verified with some independent data analysis. So I'm wary to say exactly which of those questions we should verify, but I do think that pretty soon we should jump into something that Preston brought up, which is we can start requesting data from agencies as needed. So I would just put that as a recommendation that we do that on the front end and not wait a number of months, let a number of months go by. We get a little proactive about that. Michael Bruno's initial comments about monitoring, reporting, and the actions that were taken, I think that is critical to the evaluation of a program. So I think we should be looking very carefully at that. And, you know, the other stuff, I think these are recommendations that will come out of the program, you know, aligning with Sigma. I think it's a great idea. I'm not sure if we're going to be able to do all of that before 2019 is halfway over.
Well, if you want to keep volunteering. Rob, if you have hung with us this whole time, do you have any thoughts to share on direction for the panel?
Yeah, quickly. It's 1 minute to four. No, I'm just a couple of quick thoughts. First of all, Preston, you mentioned the importance of learning. So all of us know a lot about some things, but not a lot about other things. So I'm looking forward to learning more about how things are done. Other people have mentioned well integrity, the process of exemptions. I think some discussions about historical criteria for how you determine water that will not in the future be used. What do traditional thresholds of 3,000 milligrams per liter total dissolved solids always make sense? As California relies on more and more water and deeper underground. So I'm interested in those kinds of issues, and also maybe some discussions for the group about data availability, both data available for analysis, but also are there opportunities for the state to make more data publicly available to bolster transparency and public support for some of these processes. So I'm optimistic. Many of us worked on the SB4 groundwater monitoring report. Some of us recently on the natural gas storage report. So I'm looking forward both to learning and to contributing to the effort.
Thank you, Rob. And I guess just to throw some thoughts I've had in, it's interesting looking at the record, if it's possible to do so, of MIT mechanical integrity test failures, the frequency of those relative to the frequency with which those tests are required, because maybe they're done more than they need to be done, maybe they're not done often enough. I think that's a point of view. There may be a great body of literature out there already on that, in which case it could be a literature review. And I remember years ago hearing and reading and not being entirely clear statements about cyclic steam wells are operated in a way that causes fracturing. So I don't know where that issue's at this point. I've sort of lost track of it, and I was never that clear on it originally. So I think that's something that could be looked at. And then in terms of getting data, there are historic injection project applications that are on paper in the district offices and not available. And so I think it would be nice to have at least a sample of those scanned so we could look at sort of the evolution of those with time and what the current practice is. And it'd be similar to scanning the well records that Dogger did such a great job getting online. And speaking of those records, I can certainly thank Secretary Laird, because that made my life much, much better as a researcher, as it did Jan's. those records came online just in time for a project we were working on. So with that, maybe some discussion about what the panel's druthers are for where we head next in terms of how often we meet. It's been raised that there are sort of these series of different processes that are going on that the panel could potentially engage with, look at, make comments. One of those is the MOU, but I think that's on a very short timeline.
And then there's the regulations, which I think I heard those are to go into place in December. I don't know what the public comment period is on that. And then there's the GWPC process, obviously, which we will look at and comment on. So I don't have a sense of how often you all want to meet, if you really want to dive in right away and try to look at something like the MOU with its, you know, specific nexus with the UIC. Like I say, that would require really hitting the ground running to do, I think, anything that's credible and useful there. So I'm not suggesting that we would engage in that, but it has been raised. And as a facilitator, part of my job is to sort of reflect back some of what I'm hearing. So maybe we can just go by show of hands. I mean, not show of hands, but raise your hand and I'll call on you if you have some thoughts about how fast you would like to see the panel start moving, how often you think it should meet. It could meet, you know, more often over the next month and then go on hiatus a little bit and wait for GWPC to evolve. There's a lot of different options here. Anybody have any thoughts on that? Okay, Mary Jane.
I always have a thought.
Excellent.
No, what I thought we should do is review the MOU and have a little, maybe a 45-minute meeting by electronic after we've all had a chance to review it and see if we can come up with whether or not we can reach consensus on a an opinion about the MOU itself. I know a lot of people have worked very hard on it, and I think there are enough people who know enough of the regulators to talk to them directly about their thoughts on the MOU. Does it go far enough? Does it not go far enough? That kind of thing. Because maybe we can dispense with some of the issues very quickly. The other thing I was thinking on, well, integrity and things of that nature, those are difficult data sets to look at, and there have been quite a few different studies at different times, but they're scattered and they're not all pulled together. So that kind of data, although it is public, is difficult to extract, and it's time-consuming to do it, but it is electronic. It is on... but I think there have been some studies that have been done that are probably some of them outdated, but that talked about the number of wells that had contaminated groundwater in California prior to the UIC program being initiated. And then those were updated, or non-compliance was updated. But I'm not sure if there's a current one now. Justin might know if they have tabulated that data in recent years. No. Oh, darn. That means somebody has to do it. But, and I do think it would be helpful if the Water Board and Dogger gave a presentation to the panel on the criteria for aquifer exemptions, because I know they're quite a bit different than they were at the inception of the program, and they've evolved over the last several years. And so I think that would be an important thing to maybe have another electronic presentation from the Water Board and Dogger on the criteria. How do you determine what the words mean? And I think that would be helpful to the panel.
Great, thank you.
Those are my ideas.
Great, good suggestions. And I suggested for terminology, I've heard the distinction made between information and data. So there's a lot of information, and meaning that, you know, if I scan this piece of paper and it's a bitmap, that's information, but it's not really data that you can process quantitatively, and so it has to be keyed in. So that might, if people are willing to adopt that terminology, that might help us develop a communal understanding of what's information, what's data, and information's harder to make something useful out of than data is. So I heard Mary Jane was one vote suggesting that the panel do take up the MOU, and then also this presentation on aquifer exemptions, which criteria, which could be further down the line. But I think the MOU is really what's in front of the panel if it wants to take that up or not. I don't know if we do a show of hands of how many people think the panel should take that up. That might be a useful way to go. How many people have interest in looking at the MOU? Kind of a strange thing, I know, but there's so many of us. Why don't you raise your hand if you think we should look at the MOU? I see one. I'll raise them high. I'm down here. I'm small down here. So, okay, well, I don't even count that. That's pretty much not maybe unanimous, but close to unanimous. So with that in mind, maybe I'll ask the agency staff. You said it's in public out for public comment right now?
That's correct.
Okay, and you said it was a 30-day? And we're already maybe 7 days into it, potentially 6 days into it. Okay. So then that suggests we need to move with great alacrity. Pardon me?
2 weeks.
2 weeks. You want to meet in 2 weeks? Suggesting.
Electronically.
Yeah, electronically. Yes, of course. Okay. So, I mean, I'll do the usual doodle poll business, but we'll tentatively meet in 2 weeks. Yes, Jan.
To me, I think what might be more interesting is to go through aquifer exemptions that have both been approved and disapproved, and look at the reasons for that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I would prefer that to the MOA.
To an MOU dive. Well, maybe it's a bit of divide mm-hmm. and conquer then, because it sounds like there is a lot of interest in the MOU. Some people can really take the lead on that, and then others of us can react to what they bring forward and maybe dive in. And, I think looking at aquifer exemptions over these past few years would be very useful. Again, though, I see that on a different... I can operate on a slightly different timeline. So I think... Yes,
just want to add some background. The MOU is very short. It's not War and Peace. I mean, it's...
Okay, good.
It's like 10... It's like 12... pages. It's not, and there's the appendix, but it's not.
I'm quite happy to hear that. I've heard the California Constitution called the Winchester Mystery Constitution, so I'm always worried about.
It's an easy read. It's, yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Can I ask, I want to interject one thing, I don't know if you wanted to bring it up now or one of your later meetings, the concept of field trips.
Oh, right. Yes, thank you for bringing that up. So I didn't mention that in the meeting in Bakersfield and the meeting in Long Beach. The agency raised the concept of having field trips associated with those meetings, which I know we had a field trip with the SB4 team, those who were interested. That was the hydraulic fracturing study, well stimulation study, and I found that really extremely informative. We did a much better job on the study, I think, as a result of that. So I guess that might take half a day to a day. I would think probably a day, really. So it would be an additional day. So we do the meeting on one day and probably the field trip on the other day, or maybe do part of the field trip the morning of the meeting and the meeting in the afternoon, and then another part the next day. I know in SB4, CRC, which I can't remember if it was Oxy at that point or not, but kindly hosted us at Elk Hills to actually see a hydraulic fracturing operation occurring. And then we met with various environmental groups and community groups the next day, and it was a really good balance to have both of those. And so I think if we're going to do field trips, it would be useful to do something like that. So maybe a show of hands, how many people think that they're willing to, again, you're volunteers. I'm fortunate because I'm getting paid. So you can, some of these data things you can, try to shove my way because I'm actually getting paid for this. So I can try to do some of this data analysis if I get direction. But as far as the field trips, Brianna's going, don't say that. But I'm like, I feel ethically compelled to say that. And so as far as the field trips, maybe show of hands, how many people would be interested in doing field trips in association with one or the other of these meetings? Okay, great. A lot of interest. Okay, enthusiasm. All right, thank you very much for bringing that up, Ken. I appreciate that. Yes, John.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. And also, you mentioned CBC.
Bringing in Trevor Joseph.
Trevor and also Samuel from the water.
Sam and Trevor would be great, yeah.
Sigma and Gamma potentially too, right?
I think Sigma and, Gamma's a kind of a data program, if my understanding of it is correct, but you mentioned CV salts and irrigated lands
irrigated
as
lands.
Well.
Yeah.
So maybe a primer on all three of those and how they relate or don't relate would be useful. Obviously CV salts is only involved in the Central Valley, but CV salts, Sigma, and irrigated lands.
Yeah.
Since all those programs were mentioned. So, yes, Seth.
On that point, I think if the Water Board is going to come and talk about Sigma, I think it would also be helpful to understand how that monitoring interfaces with other types of groundwater monitoring, such as how it SB4 and well stimulation. Thanks.
All right.
Well, I think at some point somebody... Maybe somebody who's actually getting paid on this project.
Maybe somebody.
Is going to have to write up, because in the end, our deliverable is supposed to be a report.
Right.
So I think at some point we're going to have to draft some kind of outline of what the scope of the report is going to be so that we can start working backwards and thinking about how many meetings we have to have, what kind of information gathering we need to do.
Yeah, so I was thinking I would take the input that you've all provided today and at least list that out in a common document. I'll set up a shared drive that we all have access to, and we'll invite you to, and then we can work from there towards an outline of what we're interested in. Thanks. So this was scheduled technically till 4:30, but I don't want to keep you all on formal time. If there are any closing remarks that anybody has or closing ideas, this certainly isn't the last opportunity by any means. But if not, I know we've been here for over 3 hours. That's a pretty good amount of time, I'd say. So maybe not seeing any protestation, we'll say the meeting's adjourned. Thank you very much. I look forward to working with you all.